हरिः ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सह वीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्तिश्शान्तिश्शान्तिः ॐ जय श्रीकृष्णचैतन्यप्रभुनित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैतगदाधार श्रीवासरिगौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्ण 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
For the brahmachari, his crowd is situated alone, or for ladies, especially for the alone, or opposite being married. How do you know if your crowd is situated?
Well,
how can you
check? Well, there's the mentions earlier that there is generally four main things that are taken into consideration. So for us, basically, we deal with three of them. The first is what the Veda says. So generally, we're not studying the Veda so much itself. Then the second is those literatures that are written on the Veda. And it means all other Vedic literatures. In other words, first is Shruti, then is Smriti. So for us, that means like what's in the Bhagavatam and the Bhagavad Gita, what our acharyas write, anything like that. So those scriptures. Then the example of the great personalities, what they do, how they behave, you know, what the acharyas recommend, and all that. And then what people advise us. Means we also have to discuss and with others who are senior to us or friends, someone who knows us and who can give advice nicely. And then there must be one's own satisfaction. One has to be satisfied. That one finds that one is comfortable doing those activities. You know, they're not too difficult that one can't do them, and at the same time is all one's basically one's abilities are engaged. So taking all that, then generally one can one situate oneself.
And sometimes with social pressure, you keep up a certain standard that's really not comfortable, but you do it for the social pressure.
Yeah. Well, you have to see is what that is in the way of social pressure. I mean, if it's like in a proper standard of sadhana, then that's not bad. Because it's just, in other words, things that are going to help us remember Krishna and are basically destroying ignorance, then we just have to see is that activity, especially if it's to do with sadhana or just the straight, sadhana or chanting the holy name, you know, things that are directly in connection with the Lord, like festivals and this. So it may be that we don't like to go where people are, this, that, but in these situations it's proper to go. So that uncomfortableness is actually just due to our, you know, material condition, nature, where the non-devotional side, but those things that naturally develop the devotional aspect, those should be taken. But it's just, basically it means in the performance of the occupational duties. Like that, when you're getting down to past sadhana into the varna ashram level, the ashram and how one maintains oneself, those are the ones, and one has to just see that one's comfortable with that. You know, and if one's not comfortable with any of them, then either we're a paramahamsa, or we need to work on it a little bit.
Another question is. In the old days, we got a training as ladies in brahmacharini ashram, austere training. And I'm really happy the training I got. not there for ladies so much anymore. So, and that's not really in the Vedic society. So, you think
it's see, the thing is austerity, one has to see what is austerity. Like Prabhupada mentions, and we were just reading some previous verses to where we are now in the sixth canto, in about Prajapati Daksha, Nat. Then Prabhupada's mentioning following the four regulative principles, taking bath in, you know, the sacred rivers like Ganga and Jamuna. These are austerity. So like in the Gita, Krishna says, what is austerity? So austerity of the body basically is cleanliness, respect of authority. You know, it gives so many different varieties of authority. Or respectable personalities, or, you know, cows. There's respecting others, being clean, and being celibate. So that would mean for the boys is that they're brahmachari, either as in the brahmachari ashram or grihastha brahmacharis as grihasthas, and for the women that means chastity. So these are then speaking, that one speaks according to shastra, like that, and doesn't speak to hurt others in this way. And then austerity of the mind, one is straightforward. And this, so these are what is actually austerity. So generally we think, you know, if we're standing on our head, you know, in a fire or something, or, you know, in the winter we're standing up to our neck in freezing cold water or stuff like that. That is austerity. But that is austerity external for the body, like that. So that is not so important in this age. You know,
it's like how we learn to study the scripture, go on sankirtan, live simple as brahmacharini.
Yeah.
So this is something missing.
Yeah. It would, because generally this would be done, because whatever would generally be the situation, that whatever's the lifestyle of the kind of family that they're in, generally that will be what they will continue in. But that simplicity must be there in those values, so that one can live a simple lifestyle like that. So that before would be given in the house. They would be taught how to use everything very nicely, be very frugal and everything, you know, very careful of everything. And the emphasis would be on the principle, because the detail, it wouldn't matter. Because then that would go, let's say if someone, many times you see someone's girl, princess, then, you know, generally she would be married to a prince. So she would basically keep the same lifestyle. But we also see examples of where they've been married to, you know, rishis and that. And then they can just easily just live like rishis, you know, especially for the Brahmin Kshatriyas. Because a Kshatriya uses all that facility for his service. You know, they're like social deities. You know, everybody is very, how you say, you know, kings and queens generally look very nice, you know. They're well ornamented, you know, they live in big palaces. So they're kind of like the people's deity. You know, on that social platform they can look up. You know, no one's looking for a poor king that doesn't know how to dress properly and, you know, looks bad and doesn't have any character, you know, like that. They want to see all these like high ideals like that. So it's there, but when they're not doing that service, then they can go to the forest. They have no problem with that. You know, they can live simply. Because they would also learn the scriptures like that. The queens and all that are very expert in the scriptures also. They just don't learn the Veda, because they wouldn't be doing the sacrifices. So the Veda is learned for doing the sacrifices. But all the knowledge of the Veda is explained in all the other literatures, like that. All the other literatures are for the purpose of understanding the Veda. So that's what they would study, which is the important part. The mantras of the Veda are only important if you're going to do a sacrifice of that. So that, because the men would be doing that, then they wouldn't worry about it. So they would study, you know, like the Upanishads for the philosophy or other aspects of the philosophy. You know, the Sanskrit, they would know astrology, they would know. They would know all the other branches, they would know. They just wouldn't memorize the Veda itself, which especially in this age isn't a problem at all. Because for us, we do all of our you know, worship and everything, generally not through Vedic mantras.
So they would give classes to ladies?
They would, but they would generally learn in the palace.
But that's only for the queen.
That would be any of those in the Kshatriya line. Also in the Vaishyas, then they would also be trained in the house. Teachers come to the house. They would have Brahmins who would come to the house and train the members of the family like that. Well, that's the general thing that applies to everyone. Just like for brahmachari, when you hear Prabhupada describes the brahmachari, he doesn't talk about academics. If you read about it, but in the Gurukul, they study that a lot. You know, Prabhupada says Sanskrit's the most important of all the academics, and they learn the philosophy, and they learn, you know, so many things. So that is the things that build the character. Because for the brahmachari, he does menial service in the ashram. So from that, he gets the benefit of living with the guru and rendering that personal service. And then the girl is trained in cooking, taking care of the house, and the household duties, how to run a proper house. Because that takes a lot of management and a lot of expertise. So the wife, by doing that, gets the same benefit of personally serving the guru. So they get the same benefits, but it's just in where they get it. So it's just two things, like it's just like you have a bowl and a spoon. A bowl and a spoon are very different. You know, and on their own, they don't have much meaning. But you put the two together, then you have a nice functioning unit. So like that, as boys are trained in certain areas, girls in the other, so when they're combined, then it makes a very nice working unit. If they're both trained exactly in the same thing, why do they have to marry each other? The boys should stay with the boys, you know? Girls should stay with the girls. But because of the training in different areas, then they match, you know? So it's just a matter of knowing what the duties are, recognizing the mentality. Then, so that's the basic, the cooking, the cleaning, because cleaning is a very broad thing. We generally think cleaning just you sweep. That's more. That's the gross aspects. Like we see in the Krishna book, after the Trinavarta demon came, and then the gopis found Krishna. You know, then they took him, and then they, you know, how you say, protected him with the dust from the cows and using chamras and using nyasas and mantras. So that's all cleanliness. And it said it was a common thing that all the ladies knew all that. So cleanliness, most of us just think, well, cleanliness means wash a pot or vacuum a rug or that. That's the gross. That's the external. That's called sthan shuddhi or dravya shuddhi. But there's four other aspects of cleanliness. Because the child learns cleanliness from the mother, how to keep clean, wash after they eat, clean up all this. So that creates a whole mentality. So if they don't know that, they won't be able to give it to the children. And one of the main aspects of austerity of the body is cleanliness. So if the women don't know that, then, you know. And then in the cooking, it means one has to maintain oneself, so eating must go on. So you have to know what to eat at what times, what seasons you can eat what times of days you can eat what you eat if there's certain diseases or certain other things like this. I mean, it's like you can ask Bengali grandmas, they can tell you exactly what to cook and what places, like, don't eat this in this season and don't eat that there. Like, Prabhupada would come up with amazing things. You have, how you say, blood dysentery, and he would say, eat hot puris with salt, or with you know, freshly cooked begun, eggplant, fried eggplant. So that's normally, that's would be the opposite, what would give you diarrhea. But if you know how to administer it, means you cook it, and as soon as it comes out of the cooking in the ghee, you just put it on the plate and eat it with salt. While it's that hot, it creates a chemical reaction in the stomach. Means that it binds everything. But if you eat it cold, then it'll make you sick. Also, if it's cooked in fresh oil or ghee, it's never been heated before, then it will create health. Well, if it's been reused, it'll make you sick. Every time you reheat ghee, it becomes toxic. So you fry something once, you know, even somebody with a weak liver, weak digestion can eat it hot and have no problem. But then tomorrow you reheat the same ghee and fry the same preparation, you'll get sick from it. So, I mean, it's a great science how to maintain the health. As I probably said, you have a feast, and when you finish, and you take all the ghee that was left from frying, and then you make halava with that. So you never reuse ghee or oil. It's only used once in cooking, like that. So these are our sciences, how to be able to do that, you know, how to use and how to save, how to not cook too much, or cook too much, what to do with it, you know. You have something left over, what you can do with it, that people want to eat it. I mean, it's a whole science, and this is, you know, very much, especially in children's, you know, eating is a very major aspect of their life, you know. You know, it's like they're on anamoy for a long time. And then at some point, pranamoy kicks in, but anamoy still remains, you know, like that, until they get bigger, and then it's kind of, then that kind of gets a little less, you know. So these are major aspects of just how to run the house. You know, and by doing that, that's what is like. Sohotamaraj was mentioning, we were discussing about some of these things, and he was saying is that in the relationship, basically the women are domesticating the men. You know, men are kind of like, you know, wild animals, you know, and the women domesticate them. They kind of bring out the finer side, you know, they dress them properly and see that they're clean and keep them in a nice aesthetic place, and that's what they look for. Because otherwise, if they wanted something rough and ready and yelled and screamed and that, they'd just stay out with the boys, you know? Because, you know, it's already happening out there. So they're looking for something more gentle and fine. That's what they feel missing in their kind of life, you know? So those are the basic elements. Then from there, every woman has her individuality. So some are into study, some are not. You know, and those who are into study, then there's so many fields. You know, some are into language, some are into the grammar, some are into poetics, some are into astrology, into astronomy, into the histories, and all these different things. So that's just there. Everybody's got their own individuality. So that they study according to their nature, according to their, you know, family background, and, you know, what's available. Like that. Like in South means basically all the, you know, aristocratic families. It means all the Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya families, any good kind of families. All the children generally learn music if there's any inclination. But it's not expected they're going to become professional musicians. It's just part of their refinement. And generally, most of the girls learn dancing up to the age of 12. Just for, you know, refinement, movement, motor skills, and things like that, poise, and all these things. But they're not planning to dance. It's not their idea. It's just some. Then they understand what the culture. So when they see a dance performance, they know what it means, like that, and they themselves can relate to it and appreciate what goes into it because they've done it. And many of the boys would also learn the dancing. It's not at all uncommon, like that. Like who would. Yeah, like that. So it would, these things would be there just for character development and that. That was not in any way, it was in no way in occupation. These are like hobbies and just finities. Human being means to get refined, like that. You're uplifting. It depends. The thing is you're always going to have first generation, you know, and now they're the prominence and they're the basically leaders of the society. But in the future, you'll probably find a few generations down will probably be more, in general, leading. And first generation, if they're exceptional, will be leading. So for them, it's many times good. So much passion is there, so many activities is there. So if they do that, it's not a problem. Point is whatever the modes one's in, one should engage those in the Lord's service. But you generally find many times with the second generation, I've seen now, second generation boys and girls, they're boys and girls. You know, the girls are girls and the boys are boys. It's like, you know, they're not like... So they can get a little bit more, you know, your traditional training. So both will go on. And if you have, it's good if both are there. But it should be understood that the how you say, the point is whatever one needs, that is what one should do. And everybody should worry about themselves. So what's good for one person may not be good for someone else. Too much of the time is you'll have girls who are not satisfied with a simple lifestyle. They're not satisfied with the, you know, simple things of the house or study and that. They're more interested in dressing up and running around and, you know, looking out for the boys and doing that kind of thing. So one can make arrangements for that, but it should be understood that that's good for them. And it should never be imposed on others who can work on a you know, more traditional platform. And those that can follow the more traditional platform, they should also understand that there are, you know, conditionings are different. So then those who need to live in that kind of way, it's not a problem. You know? But on those areas, there may be very little intermingling, you know. I mean, it's in temple programs and things that are purely devotional, then there may be a nice interaction. But when it comes to how they spend their day or their hobbies, then there may be complete difference. And if that's not, that should be, that should be, that freedom should be there. But understanding that you're dealing with different modes here, then there has to be some kind of, you know, how you say, space given. So those who want to be more Western liberal, then they should do that in an area that's not going to bother those who are more conservative. You know, whether they're Western conservative or, you know, Vedic conservative, because both of them will not appreciate the liberalness. So like that, you know, in the Grihastha you can just create different communities, you know, different areas, you know. And then there's more kind of bonding in the community there. You know, but it's just a matter of, to do this means you have to have people who can appreciate what their own conditioning is and what is required to take care of it, and not have the, you know, natural, either, you know, we're better because we're more conservative, or we're better because we're more liberal and we're not, you know, closed-minded and like that. And especially Westerners have to get away from their imperialistic, you know, social nature. It means the mood of managing and being able to take a leading role, that's fine. That's there, you have to engage it, but they should also understand that it's only useful as far as management goes. When it comes to culture, it's an absolute disaster. I mean, the imperialistic cultures have destroyed every other culture of the planet. You know, systematically destroyed. Like
so
that.
They
should take in families, amongst themselves, with children. That's always there. Because it's like understood is that, especially amongst the Grihasthas, is the man is doing, you know, very well and being able to do what he does because he has that backup and support of the women of the family and community. So it's just, so they do lead, but they lead in a behind the scenes way, which is actually more powerful. I mean, it's just like, which is more deep, the relationship with acquaintances that's out in the open and, you know, so much known and seen, or the relationship with intimate friends, which actually has, socially, one is seen more, but which has more influence on your life? You know, it's the intimacy. It's there. So the women in the community and in the families actually have the most influence. Like that. But it's somehow another, the culture nowadays has become so shallow that external, you know, is seen as the main thing. But it's not. The Vedic culture, it's not the main thing. Because that's always changing. Every 5-10 years it changes. You know, the political scene, everything changes. But the home scene remains. You know, that doesn't change. So that's where the main influence, the main satisfaction and all that is on that platform of intimacy. So the social, the external is not the main factor. You know, like in the Brahmacharya also, they don't get involved in that so much. They're in the intimacy of the ashram with the teacher, with other Brahmacharis like this, or those leading members of the community that they may deal with. That's fine. You see, it comes down to this: is guna and karma. If a woman can actually do it, but it has to be able to get the result. They also can't be just proud and just because they're the longest around. Maybe they could do it 5 years ago, but now they can't. You know, maybe when they were younger and more fired up, but as they get older, then if they demand that respect and authority and facility that comes with that, then it's a problem. Because in the Vedic system, the vanaprastha may be an authority knowledge-wise, but as far as social, managerial influence, there was zero. So what happens now is that somebody retires, but they want to still have full control. So that's why everything gets messed up, you know? I mean, it just goes across the board. You know, let's say, well, sannyasis aren't, but also the vanaprasthas aren't, you know, like this. And so everybody, one has to know, what is it? Good fences make good neighbors. One has to know one's line of control, where the demilitarized zone is, you know? Like that, then things can work. But the problem comes is just in the Western culture is just you hold on until you're dead. You know, that's the only reason you stop. It's either die or somebody kills you. You know, that's the problem.
I guess that's why we had as first generation a lot of problems with marriages because of this aspect.
Yeah, that and just not balancing, not knowing. See, it's like. There's just general human behavior. How men and women behave, how you deal with children, how you deal with cows, how you deal with older person, respect. That all remains. It's then in that where you put the emphasis. Just like when we have a meal. In the meal, let's say there's 5 different items. Now, you can put the emphasis anywhere. You know, we can put it on the drinks. Or let's say we can put it on, vegetables, or you can put it on the grains, or fried things, or on chutneys, or on sweets. So depending upon where you put the emphasis, the meal takes a whole different flavor. Like that. So, but all the elements should be there. But what's happened is because we're not, the Westerners aren't used to, means in old school there's some idea of that. You basically go back in all cultures of the world generally have a certain way they dress, a certain way they eat, you know, and they do have all these restrictions and all that, either coming from the locale, from their religion, just survival, you know, something creates it. Then there's a little bit more understanding of you just convert all these things, you know. Okay, we have an order what we follow, you know, the soup, then the salad, and then the main meal, then the sweets, like this. Okay, now we have bitter, then we have spinach, and we have like this. So the principles are there, how it's done, served, meals are served. Like you go, like, even like in the English, in the aristocracy and all that, they have a meal, somebody serves a meal. You don't take it yourself. You have a big social gathering, people serve, and everybody knows how to serve, because everybody... What's an interesting thing is it's a common now, like in England, everybody goes to finishing school. So everybody knows the system. Everybody knows the culture. There's a common culture on how you sit, how you eat, how you host a party. You know, how you figure out who should sit with who, you know, so you don't have 2 people that don't have something in common. And if you do, and if you end up sitting next to someone you have nothing in common with and can't start a conversation, you blame the host. That how come they didn't know that our natures are so different? Because these are all the things they're trained in. And if the host sees that 2 people aren't getting along, they come along and, you know, take one of them and, oh, I'd like to introduce you to, and take them off and hook them up with somebody else. And they just kind of like see that everybody's satisfied, you know? You know, so the whole thing is though it's, you know, it's shallow in its own way because it has no God consciousness. But the point is that the idea was that there is some common culture and some way of dealing. So they would do this. So that has to be understood. And then if it's there, then devotees will look for it and try to gain it. So in this, what we're starting on is that all these things are there. Prabhupada's talking about in his books, purport after purport about the culture. And then purport after purport about sadhana. And then about the importance of the chanting of the holy name. So all is supposed to be there. But we know as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, the emphasis is on the Bhagavat. Is on the chanting, hearing and chanting of transcendental, the name, form, qualities and pastimes of the Lord.
That's
for everybody. And then everybody has sadhana. And then everybody has some prescribed duties according to their conditioned nature. Like that. But the emphasis is always on the chanting of the holy name. But what was happening is devotees took that as the focus and didn't understand that the others actually, it's sadhana, but didn't understand that also the social structure that Prabhupada talks about so much is also an important part. So that was dropped.
Because
or misused, right?
We're not trained like this because Prabhupada emphasized the first.
That's because if you don't emphasize that, then you end up with Hindus. Because the Hindus follow the culture very nicely, but they don't know that you know, serving the Lord and going back to Godhead is the importance. So he said the whole thing, and then where's the emphasis? But then we've taken that fanatic, because basically Western culture is all or nothing. So we just took the Bhagavat and threw everything else out, you know? And then that's it. But you're supposed to balance the whole thing. You just know where the emphasis is. Like you see much more, ours is totally on the Bhagavat as, you know, fully manifest. And that's supported by the Pancharatrik and then, you know, backed up by the Vedic. Like you take the Ramanujas and Madhvas, then their emphasis is more on the Pancharatrik. Though the purpose of that goal is the Bhagavat, and then they bring out a lot the Vedic. Like that. So the same things or elements are there in all the Vaishnava Sampradayas. It's just where they put the emphasis, you know. Well, like in the what do you call it? The Vallabhas. Then they emphasize a lot the Pancharatrik and the Bhagavat, kind of in between, but more the Vaidhi side of the sweet Vaidhi side of the Pancharatrik, and then the kind of more general, how do they call it? Pusti Marg, the nourishment. Like that, it's just, you know, they dress very, their whole idea is, I dress very nicely for the deity. I dress nicely, keep their hair nicely, put nice perfumes, and they dress very opulently and deal like that, because they give great opulence to the Lord. So they bring out that aspect more. While for us, so they deal the external pushti, while we deal the internal pushti. We're also pushti marg. But for us, that's the internal development. That's the thing we're dealing with. So we'll also say we're Pushti Marg, but we're not that kind of Pushti Marg. So it's just where you put the emphasis. The process is the same. All these things, just where you put the emphasis. So probably put it there. Otherwise, as you see now, is now devotees are just taking it and throwing it towards the Vedic, but not taking the Vedic. They want the social, but not necessarily the Vedic paradigm. So then, and in that, sadhana is sacrificed, the Bhagavad is sacrificed, you know, I mean, just, you know, Bhagavad is, you know, hearing, you know, chanting Hare Krishna in the Samkirtan, preaching. So we see that goes down. Everything must stop until we get the social scene together, right? Preaching everything. All money has to go into this. Don't build a big temple. We got to do this, right? So that being sacrificed. Then hearing the Bhagavatam. Right? Devotees many times read more Kavi and other things than they do that. You know, most of their management discussions, they're not discussing how Prithu Maharaj or this one or that one managed, just, you know, what Kavi says and what this one and that one says. Association of devotees, like that. It's new bhaktas before they even have fully moved in the temple. They've been trained by senior members of the yatra all the faults of every GBC man and every guru that ever, you know, lived on the planet. You know, before they moved in. Like that. Like that. Then worship of the deity, you know, I mean, that's, you know, completely, you got, you know, more, some temples you have more deities than devotees. You know, living in the Dham, you know, it's not so common now, you know. No one likes to live in the temple. Their house isn't so much run as a temple. Mayapur, you come for the meetings, you know, and then, you know, once the important stuff is over, then you leave, you know. You know, festival, that's, we got more important things to do. Prabhupada, you're coming to the festival to be in the Dham and to recharge your batteries. And since everybody's here, then we can have a meeting also. Right? But now it's, you just come for the meeting and then you leave. Right? So these five, which are the main elements of the, of the, you know, of the Bhagavat, of the, or how you say, the upper, that are there in the Bhagavat, all these five are mukya. I mean, these actually liberate you. And so they're essential parts of the, they're the essential aspects of the Bhagavat. They're the essence of the Pancharatrik. And they're actually what is the underlying force behind the Vedic. So the Vedic just gives a lot, goes a lot broader in all this. You know, it's like, okay, you associate with devotees, but, you know, you invite them to your house, how you put out a mat, how you do this, how you do that, and then who you respect in this way, who you respect in that way, and who's called a guest, who's not called a guest, who's, you know, they just get into unlimited rules like that. The social side of that. While the Pancharatra just gets into the sadhana side of that. And then the Bhagavat just gets into the main, how you say, just the, its relationship to just the pure devotional, you know, the mood, the philosophy, like that, and its application of just chanting and getting others to chant. So we see that if Prabhupada hadn't done that, the natural tendency is just to flip it into, you know, Hinduism. Because as soon as you have a nice culture running, but it's not based on going back to Godhead, that's been compromised, that's Hindus. Devotees may say no, but you go out there and every Hindu knows, you know, Krishna's God, you know, like that. Some may be confused and think everybody's God, but I mean, there's millions and millions of people who know Krishna's God, and they worship God, and they know that's there. But first they're going to do all their Vedic duties and all this and stuff like that. And then when they're older, then they'll get serious about the sadhana. Right? And then when they get serious about the sadhana, then they start, you know, they may or may not know about the Bhagavad aspect. So, you know, what's the difference? Like that. So, therefore, Prabhupada emphasizes this. So it's not his fault. It's our fault for not understanding. A good disciple understands what the spiritual master wants without being told. He hears the instruction and he understands what it is that the spiritual master is saying. Second class disciple is told, you do this. And then he does it. Right? And third class, you know, second class sees. Others are instructed. And then he gets, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do. Third class has to be told. Fourth class, after being told, doesn't follow. So Prabhupada, I mean, it's just, how you say? I mean, if you look at it from a social point of view and look at Prabhupada's purports, I mean, there's thousands of purports that just deal with varnashram and interaction between members of the society. Constantly it's there. Little points, and even sometimes fine points. You know? Even fine points he's telling. You know, the kind of more secret points you would normally hear from your mother or father, or like that. You know, they take you aside and say, hey, like this. They're written into there. But, you know, generally devotees will just take, well, that, it's like if it happened at that time, it can't be applied now. So that's why the people who are history majors in university say, the only thing you learn from studying history is no one learns from studying history. Because they always think, oh, well, that was, you know, 50 years ago, 100 years ago. It doesn't apply today. Why? Because I am so special. I am so unique in this whole cosmic manifestation, that whatever anybody's thought before or done before doesn't really apply to me. So it's just false ego. You know, when the acharyas say chewing the chewed, they know what they're talking about. The same pleasure that, you know, the kid is, you know, getting, eating something that his mother cooked, is the same pleasure that a kid 1,000 years ago got. Is the same pleasure that the bird gets when his mother brings him a worm. There's no difference. One may think, well, it's more refined. The interaction is the same. The dependence is the same. The emotional exchange is the same. There's no difference. Because this is the senses. It's the same as the animals. So it's going on. You know, we'll see a dog today and a dog 100 years ago. It's the same. Their experience is the same. So the same, the humans, it's that. It's just situations change, but within that, eating, sleeping, mating, defending is still going on. If it changed, then why we haven't stopped these things? You know, we've evolved or something, you know, so now we don't eat or, you know, the same. So that's the thing, is the reality is we're just an ordinary living entity. It means as a soul, we're unique, but our conditioned nature is just very ordinary, that has been around for millions of years, and there's probably millions of souls who have gone through exactly the same situation. Right? Because everything's controlled by the modes, so you're only going to get what the modes work out for you. Right? Someone goes down to the beach and gets on a surfboard and rides a wave. You know, it's the same thing that, you know, thousands of people all over the planet do. So it's not something new and unique and all that. You're getting the same experience. But we think I am getting something specialized that no one else gets. That's just due to false ego. I mean, there's animals that do that kind of stuff. You know? Like skiing. I think it's beavers or that. They get into the snow and ice and make slides and that and go through it and go down and then at the end go into the water and all that. And, you know, the human thinks he's very special because he's made, you know, some water wonderland and all that. But that's the false ego. Because the living entity wants to make himself seem unique and special. And that makes him feel very comfortable. So that's the first thing in the Vedic culture that's gone after is the false ego. Is the false ego then, yeah. The false ego is the first thing they deal with. You know, who we are. And then after that, then they start dealing with the intelligence, then with the mind, then with the senses. You know, senses meaning the body. So like that, then they're dealing. So that's the first thing. So that's why the first point is that, you know, there is God, and we're not our body, and we're servant to the Lord. That establishes the actual ego. Then based on that, all other instructions come out. Then all your activities are based on that. So when we apply Abhideya, or the process of devotional service, it has to be applied on the principle that I'm not this body, I'm servant of God. You know? And then we're dealing with Varnashram, it's because of the same thing. Like that. So our sadhana, it's the same thing. Our chanting, it's the same thing. So it must always be that consistency going back to that. And then that point is based, so yeah. Does that make some sense?
A lot of attachments.
Yeah. So that's the whole thing. So Hotra Maharaj made the point is that the Vedic culture is a culture of humans. And the whole thing is based on the culture of goodness. Everyone is cultivating goodness. Bhagavatam mentions if a Shudra doesn't aspire to develop the qualities and values of a Brahmin, there's a hell he'll go to. If a Shudra just acts as a Shudra and is satisfied with that, he'll go to hell. Because the whole purpose is to try to elevate yourself.
So the ladies.
Yeah, that's automatic. It means just everybody has to try to. Yeah, so the whole culture is based on goodness. So that's why it's such a superior culture. And that's why it's generally not noticed. Because we're so conditioned to passion and ignorance from the West that something goodness, we think it doesn't get anything done. But at the same time, it's really a wonderful, you know, interesting point is that, especially like New Age and all these different things that come up, all the managing systems, they all talk about being nice and just and honest and all that, which are coming from the natural qualities of the soul. When the soul gets situated in goodness, these things automatically manifest. So they want that result, because only in the platform of goodness can the society actually interface with each other and work peacefully. But we don't want to use the methods that bring us to goodness, or we don't want to work within the platform of goodness. You know, so it's a very strange. We want our cake. We want to be able to eat it. We want to be able to distribute it and get all the, how you say, credit for having given it away. You know, we want to be able to invest it. We want to be able to sell it and make profit. You know, we want to do everything. You know, so it's not very intelligent. So it's like the West is very advanced technologically, but socially is very problem. That's what Prabhupada said, lame man, blind man. Is India is not blind. The West is blind. You know, end sentence, full stop. The West is blind. But they are very strong. They have that drive to get things done. India, because it's not properly practicing the culture, has become lame. But they have the vision. So you can still understand what is the vision. Like that. So you put the two together, the Westerners drive with the vision of the Vedic literature, then you have what the Vedic culture used to be. Like that. Because that's what, you don't see lazy, you know, or useless people in the Bhagavatam. So the Vedic culture is very dynamic. Very dynamic. But it's become, you know, with time it's just become lame. Prabhupada said, was it? An elephant. He compared India like an elephant. Dead or alive, it's worth a lakh of rupees. If it's alive, you got to pay a lakh of rupees to get one. And if it's dead, all the bones, everything are made of ivory, so you can sell that and get a lakh of rupees. So either way, you know, there's no loss in investing in an elephant. So the Vedic culture is like that. Yeah. Whether it's nicely being practiced or whether it's just in the form of theory, doesn't matter. You know, and even what's there now in India, you know, you may say it's, you know, dead, but there's so much more of value you can gain from it than there is from anywhere else in the world. Yeah. I mean, it's still, even though it's not being practiced well, it's still very much alive. You know, whatever Prabhupada talks about, you can still see today. The only thing you don't see, the only one thing he's talked about I haven't seen is the one where he mentions about his mother. When she would go next door, just to the next house, they would get the carriage, she would get in the carriage, and then they'd pull it out in the street and push it back in the neighbors, and then she would get out and go there. That's the only thing I haven't seen. But that's it. Everything else he talks about, I've seen. You know? So it's going on in India today. It's alive. You know, much to the, how you say? May not, those many devotees, they may not believe that. Because you many times hear the comment, okay, you know, 100 years ago when Prabhupada, you know, was there, yes, it could have been followed. Or 500 years ago with the time of Lord Chaitanya. And most say, okay, you know, back in, you know, before the Kali Yuga and Dwapara Yuga, you could follow it. But amazingly enough, you know, millions of people still follow aspects of it today. So one can take that example from here and there, you know, take gold from a dirty place. So one family, you see one aspect, then you learn, oh, that's how it's done. That's the art of application of that. Then the other one, then the other, and you put it all together, it works. Yeah. So it's there. It's alive and well. Yeah. Any other questions on that?
Just
this morning, Pankaj Dhangari mentioned that he was talking in his lecture that how we have to take vanaprastha. And I wondered how do we have an initiation for getting married. You have a yoga. You have so many ceremonies like you were brahmachari, you take initiation, sannyas initiation. Is there some kind of rites of passage to go actually
to vanaprastha?
You know, is there something we are not doing or we don't know
about? No, I've never seen anything mentioned for that because that's just the next stage, it's the last stage of grihastha life. Like that. So it's more of it's a change of the mentality. And because of that, then the external changes. Like that.
What kind of external changes?
Means the external changes you'll see because the values of, let's say, increasing things in the house, facility and the securities of that situation will be more, have to be more strong in grihastha life. But then in vanaprastha life, that value is not so much. It switches more to just what you need to just maintain. So the life and the lifestyle therefore becomes simpler. You see that then they don't worry necessarily as much about maintaining, you know, all the facilities to the same kind of standard. Like that, their lifestyle, maybe their eating or their dressing. You know, these things may just with time just naturally start to simplify. One doesn't worry about these things so much and all that. Like you see that in India all the time, is the younger women are very worried about how they dress, everything's just perfect, and the older women don't really care so much like that. Because you know, it's beyond, they don't worry. Because that's not, they worry more about other things. You know, they're chanting and their own sadhana, their study, what service they can render, like that. So because of emphasizing that more, you know, as the children kind of grow up and these things, and one doesn't have to take care of these anymore so much, naturally it gives more time. So then they just invest their time into these things. Like that. So that's the natural course of the Vedic culture. That's what should happen. You know, one has to be very careful, as otherwise, you do also see that some get stuck, is that they retire from the main activities, but they're very much involved to see that the next generation is doing it. So they themselves can't do it, but they're very just right there, always seeing that the next generation is doing it. So they let the next generation run it. So they're satisfied, but they never really let go, you know. You know, you see this many times in business families. You know, ones that are very aristocratic, then not so much, but your general business families, they never really get into, you know, the vanaprastha is more superficial. They retire, but they'll still sit at the, you know, down at the shop, and they'll be reading their Gita or chanting, but they'll be watching whatever the son does. And if he doesn't do something right, they'll call him over and tell him. You know, they'll always ask, what was the prophet? What was this? That? So they're very much part, just kind of like, you know, socially. Yes?
I went to a shop in Broad. It was like that. The father sat on the same seat for 17 years, and then one day he wasn't there anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, and on the side, but he's watching everything.
He's on the side for 17 years. He sat there, and one day he was dead.
Yeah, yeah. And before that 17 years, he was sitting where the sun was sitting.
Yeah.
You know, so that's very common because in the non-Vaishnava, you know, Varnashram, then generally Vaishyas don't take vanaprastha because they just can't give up that attachment. They've worked so hard, built up the business, they just can't cut off and just leave it to the sun and just get it and go to Vrindavan and all that. That's why I was mentioned in the Nectar Devotion. A special mention was given to one big aristocratic, you know, Vaishya named Lala Babu. And he gave everything up and went to Vrindavan. Probably had mentioned that because it's not so common amongst the Vaishya community. Bengali more. But in other parts of India, not so much, you know. South also a bit more, but otherwise not. But definitely the Kshatriyas, the Brahmins would. But in the Daivavarnashram, everybody's following the values and culture, basically. It means the culture of, you know, your daily activities and that, of just how you live your life, of Brahmin. because Vaishnav means realized Brahman. So it's automatic, you know, basic standards of cleanliness and this. Just the occupational dealings may not, duties may not be so technically Brahminical. But the culture of, you know, taking bath in the morning and putting tilak and wearing devotional clothes and all that, that aspect of the Brahminical culture that everyone follows, you know, taking prasadam like this, that kind of a thing. That's done by everybody in it. So then it's natural that the at least the vanaprastha stage will come in the Vaishnava community. You know? But you know, that's, everything's very individual. But that's, see, if you don't push that, you don't get just below it. If Prabhupada doesn't push sannyas, then you're not going to get good vanaprasthas. And if he just says, well, you know, sannyas, vanaprastha, then maybe you'll get decent grihasthas. And if you say, well, this and that, then you're going to get lower. So it's always at point shutra nasras. You shoot for that, and then if you don't make it, if you make it, great. And if you don't, if you drop back from there, it's still very glorious. But if we just talk ordinary, then you're going to get less than ordinary. You know? That's always the thing. You know, the student never gains as much as what the teacher has. So you must always set very high ideals. So if the student has the ability, they can surpass the teacher. And then if they don't, they may get equal to the teacher or just a little below. But if you just talk, you know, kind of just simple and like that, you only do that when someone has a problem reaching the higher and they're feeling bad for that. Then you say, no, it's okay. You just do what you can and all that. But when they're inspired, then you push for high levels. That's just the way, you know, human nature works. And especially Westerners, the thing is, you know, you always have to conquer, make the top, make everything, you know. So then you push that, and then they'll go for that. And some do well, some don't. But I would say the main problem, just there related with Mataji's last question, is devotees don't study. Prabhupada kept mentioning time and time again, read the books. He wanted everyone to read at least, you know, ideally 2 hours a day. And I think minimum, okay, 1 hour a day. You know, he would complain many times. I think he said the only complaint he has about his disciples, they don't read his books. You know, he wrote the books for them to read, but they don't read them. They're busy distributing them, you know, but they're not reading them. So because of that, then one doesn't necessarily have the tools of knowledge that is required to run the social system. Because Prabhupada explains it. If you read, then you start to pick up on it. You know? But if you don't read, then, you know. And then someone may say, I read, but then he also said you must study. Because it's two different things. Read means I start from the front of the book, I read through to the back of the book. Study means I try to take topically, try to understand a point. Like you're not your body is spoken of throughout the Gita. So you're going to read about it in the second chapter. You're going to be reading about it throughout the book. But then if you take that as a topic, then you put all those together and you see the broadness of what it actually means. Like that. So they're two different modes. So reading must go on and then study must go on. Like that. So everyone must read, and then on top of that, especially this Bhakti Shastri, Bhakti Vaibhav, and things like that. So reading, studying, both are going on. Then with that, then you start to gain what Prabhupada is talking about in the culture, in the sadhana, and in the Bhagavat, you know, the actual chanting of the holy name. You understand where the emphasis is, but you understand the importance of the others. If it wasn't important, then the activities in the Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita would simply be about chanting the holy name. You know, you would only hear about Haridas Thakur in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. You wouldn't hear about Shivananda Sen and, you know, his raising his family. And you wouldn't hear about anything else in the Bhagavatam except Sukadeva Goswami getting born and running off into the forest. But all these other stories are there so that we can develop those sides. But the emphasis isn't on that. Like in the Bhagavatam discusses all aspects of grihastha life. You know, right down into intimate detail. But but the emphasis is not there. It's always on another point. So when devotees read it, they go, well, this is Bhagavatam, it's just philosophy. But that's the point, is that the cultures follow, but the emphasis is on the philosophy. So the perfect examples are given there. You know? But then devotees will see the external paraphernalia. You can't have kshatriyas unless you have kings and swords and, you know, all that regalia. But that's not what makes a king. A king just he does what is respected in that culture he's in. You know? Like in the Kerala culture, the kings there I don't think wore much ornaments or crowns or anything like that. You know? They dressed very, very simply. You know? Generally any at least in previous times you don't see so much emphasis on that. Like that. North you would see more, you know. That would be a general standard, you know, because Kerala is a little out of the way. It's kind of mountainy there, so that flavors a little bit there. So it's just whatever is respected and nice and, you know, that's all. Amongst our culture, they dress nicely, they're very clean, you know, very proper in their habits, very regulated, you know. They know what they're doing, you know, they see to discipline and that everyone's following nicely. They deal in a very kind of like, how you say, mood of sheltering, fatherly, you know, kind of like exemplary way, like this. So that's what makes a kshatriya. But devotees will just see the external. Well, you know, we don't have crowns and chariots and all that, so we can't have kings. Somehow or another, we don't have crowns and chariots, but we're still eating. You know, like that. You know, it still goes on. Therefore, you see, the Bhagavatam mentions these points, so you have something to appreciate and meditate on. But at the same time, the emphasis is always on the emotional exchange between the kshatriyas, the brahmins, and the citizens. If you look at all the kshatriyas mentioned in the Bhagavatam, that's what's explained. Their own personal sadhana, devotional commitment, and how they relate with everybody else, you know, like that. That's what you see mentioned there. You don't see other things mentioned. Like that. So. Thank you. That's what we're supposed to gain, because that's what really makes. The kshatriya is the mood. The brahmin is the mood. Vaishya is the mood. Right? If I just go out and buy a few things and then try to sell it, that doesn't make a vaishya. Vaishya has to have the mood of being able to understand what is needed, how to find and buy things cheap. I mean, it's a whole art. I had one devotee here, who used to live here from Marwari background, which is like, you know, typical Indian business community, you know, more than typical. Then he was doing business, set up, you know, his father done cloth, he set up also in cloth. Then he's going through, and from what he knows, he would buy stuff, you know, it's like he'd go out and buy saris for his wife and stuff. So then he would contact some people and then find out how they either get from them cheaply, right? Then after some months or some years, he'd find out that this guy, he gets from someone else. So then he finds that person who does the wholesale of, you know, the saris. Then after a while, he finds out that guy gets from, you know, that's the distributor for that part of Calcutta. Then there's a distributor for the whole of Calcutta. You know, then he finds that guy. Just after the years, someone mentions this and that, and, you know, he gets the nuances. He's looking for anything. Where's source? So he thinks this guy's source. Then from inference or from reference, or, oh, I don't have, the guy didn't show up, or then he understands, oh, there's another source. And then slowly, slowly, he works it out, you know, until he finds it. Then he gets to that source. Then he finds out that guy gets from another guy another guy who gets from the, you know, the people who make it, right? And then after a long time, he finds out who are the guys that actually manufacture them and buys directly from them. And that takes him 5 years. But because he's a Vaishya, he's done that. So now his profit has you know, doubled. That's a Vaishya. So it's not just that I bought something, I went out and, you know, got in my car, drove to Calcutta, bought a few things, drove back, and then sell something at some outrageous price and can't figure out why nobody buys. You know, like that, you know, like that. Businessman means I get a ride to Calcutta free. Then I get my stuff, I walk to the place, get the stuff, get a free ride back, or, you know, okay, I'll take the bus, you know, and then I sell it. That's a businessman. So austerity is there. So austerity is there in that, austerity is there in being a Kshatriya, austerity is there in being a Brahmin, austerity is there in being an artist. So that's why austerity is pushed so much in the Vedic culture, because without it, you can't occupationally survive. So when devotees say that we haven't been socially set up or financially set up, because no one's austere. And if one wants confirmation of that, just ask any successful devotee businessman what they think of devotees as hired people, and they'll say they're the worst people on the planet. You know, they'll say, you know, some will, just as a rule, won't hire devotees. Some will if they, you know, try. You know, they have this sentiment of I should. So if the guy looks okay, I'll try him. He doesn't. You know, one devotee who does business, it was asked, well, do you hire devotees? And he says, generally not. It's all karmis. And they said, why? He says, because karmis have a sense of time and obligation. They know if it's a 9-to-5 job, they're there at 9 and they go at 5. And they know if they don't do that, they don't get paid. He says, the devotee will call you up at 10:30 and say, well, you know, I was a little late, you know, the Bhagavatam class went over and then the kids had to drop them off at school and the wife had to go to the doctor and, you know, I'll be down there. But they still expect they're going to leave at 5. The devotee won't think, I came 2 hours late to work, I'll stay till 7. He doesn't think like that. No, I'll leave at 5. In fact, I got to go pick up my wife, you know, from the doctor and the kids from the school, so I got to leave at 3. And they want full payment. So the karmis are a little more realistic on this. So they say, we don't do it because devotees have no concept of time. So they won't hire them. So you put that together with, well, nobody gave, and that means then you have people who don't know how to manage. That's why. Otherwise, the people who are millionaires now, they've been doing it for years. You know? While everybody else is saying, hey, we got left out, they've already made their million in the same time. So it just basically means those who say all these things are workers who don't know how to work for people, and no one wants to hire them. That's the reality. You know? Or Brahmins who can't hold down a brahminical service and be satisfied with the results they get from it. Yes, Mata?
Maharaj, the essence of working according to our nature would seem to be that then we can get to the point where we get it down so it's second nature and we can just get on with it.
Yeah, that's the whole idea of the Vedic culture. Is that the aspects of the Vedic things, occupation, that should be second nature. You just have it, you just accept it, do it, it becomes habit. Then your mind can focus on actually the more useful things in life, like your sadhana and the chanting of the holy names. That's actually what it's for. That's why everybody's given duties, and if you just follow that, it's just like Mathis was mentioning about women, what they do and not do. I mean, there's women in America, they've been jumping up and down about not doing their duties for the last 15 years, but they're not also absorbed in their sadhana and all these kind of things. You know, we don't want to do this, we're chanting 64 rounds, you know, let the men, you know, boil their own, you know, 2-minute noodles, you know, something like that. You know, it's like, but you don't see that. It's just, you know, politics and email and all that kind of stuff. So neither are they getting the benefit of the actual, you know, Vaishnav culture, and neither are they getting any satisfaction out of the Vedic. So they get stuck, you know, they don't really get what they're looking for. So the whole idea is that if I know I do this, that just becomes routine. So most will say, well, it gets boring, I don't want to do that, because that part of life is supposed to be boring. I mean, is it like exciting every time you go to the toilet? You know? I mean, after a while, I mean, just for myself, I find, you know, you do some great thinking in the toilet. You know? Because when you're in the toilet, all other activities you forget about. You know, just, you know, going to the toilet like takes preference. It just like cleans the mind out. No anxieties. But because it's so habit, you don't have to think about what you're doing. You know, minimal concentration. And then you can think about, you know, different points, philosophy, your service, things like that. I mean, many, many, you know, how you say, thinkers and all that, they say some of the best moments are, you know, when they're taking bath or in the toilet or taking a walk. You know, something you just don't think about, it's just habit, like walking. You don't have to think about each step, therefore it's exciting. You know, they're like a little kid, they take each step, they're fully concentrating, and then it's exciting. So it's not expected that the household duties are going to be exciting. That's just, you just do those. What's exciting is afterwards you're reading, chanting, associating with devotees, doing all those things. That's what's exciting. The Veda is just this habit. You just do that. So it's has to become second nature. Just like habit, we just get up in the morning and go see Krishna. Then we're able to work on the Bhagavad aspects of actually remembering Krishna as a person. I want to go see Krishna in the morning. So it's already habit that I get up. What if I want to go see Krishna, but I don't have the habit? So I oversleep, or, you know, forget to set my alarm clock, or stay up too late at night, and or eat too much at night, and all these different things. Each day a different thing. I can't get up in the morning. How much frustration is there? So the whole idea is you just cultivate that, and when that's steady, then naturally the higher element can become the prominent. You're trying to get to that. The excitement's at the higher end. No one's saying the excitement. I mean, is it exciting, like, for the teacher to every day, you know, sit down and have assembly, you know, chant through the mantras every day and tell everybody to sit nicely and behave and don't kill each other in the classroom and, you know, don't draw on the desks? And is that exciting? No, but that has to be done. You know? So every service has its boring side. I mean, it's just the way it is. There's nothing that is, and it's what you make of it, the relationship. Like cooking, so it'll tell you very boring. But I know people who are cooks, it's exciting. Why? Because they're cooking for devotees. They know that, oh, it's a big feast, I'm either cooking a preparation that the Lord likes or something that the devotees will like. And then you'll see them, they'll, after they want to go out and serve it, you know, and take part in the whole thing. Because they see the interaction. You know, they don't think, well, I got to cut all the vegetables and then my clothes are going to go all dirty and I'm going to get all sweaty from doing this. And, you know, I'm going to have to yell and scream to get enough people to cut the sabji. And then I got to clean up all the pots. That's just secondary. You don't even think about that. That's just comes with it. So the problem nowadays is everybody wants the back half of the, you know, the goose that lays the golden eggs, but no one wants the front half. And that's the problem, is the reluctance to follow prescribed duties because there's a side of it they don't like. That's exactly why Krishna says, don't do someone else's duty, even though it's perfectly. Do your own. The reason someone would do someone else's duty is because they think it's more exciting. I'll do the exciting aspects of mine and the exciting aspects of the other. You know? Like that, but it doesn't work like that. So therefore it's very hard to run these things because of the lack of sensitivity. Devotees talk about sensitivity, but the lack, you know, the lack is there. And sensitivity is not just external. It's to the spiritual needs, then to the emotional, then naturally to the external. And it's understood in that order. And it's understood that they're connected to the conditioned soul. So when Prabhupada asks, has somebody taken prasad? One is saying, no, by being engaged in this, their mind will be peaceful. You know? Then by taking prasad, they are purified and elevated. Then it's part of the sadhana. Then they'll be able to chant nicer. He's not just worried about the body. But he knows for the conditioned soul, that aspect's not there. You know, plus it's the culture. You know, he is the, you know, is the father, fatherly figure, then taking care of the children. So it all goes together. But the focus has to be on the Bhagavad. Otherwise, then everything gets thrown off. Mm-hmm. I must beg everyone's forgiveness that, you know, when I've been speaking on these for, you know, so many months, I overemphasize the importance of this, just because I've, you know, it appears to me, at least from my vantage point, that devotees have missed this point. And because of this, then they're thinking either the Vedic system's useless or devotional life is lacking, you know, or Prabhupada was wrong. So many things. But it's just Prabhupada said all these things, so we should take it. But actually, if you'll find when Prabhupada talks about these things, he doesn't emphasize this aspect so much. He'll simply say, give some general points that are, you know, specifically applicable, and then saying that the leaders of society should study, you know, Manasamhita and other things like that. They should get the details, and then they should implement it. Because that's just easy. The rules are there. You learn them. You understand them. You teach it to others. That's secondary. Because that's just the rule's the rule. You know, it says you get up from Mangalartik. You don't have to overemphasize that unless no one's getting up from Mangalartik. Then you have to overemphasize how important it is, this and that. Otherwise, you just talk on that. Like for the Westerners, it's so much absorbed in the bodily concept. Therefore, Prabhupada is talking so heavily on you're not this body. And then Prabhupada's godbrothers then will say, well, Prabhupada doesn't talk about the higher aspects. Prabhupada talks about all those. But he knows for the Westerners, is they can't even figure out they're not the body. Let alone that, you know, I'm a maidservant of Srimati Radharani, you know. But so he emphasizes that point. And then others say, oh, he hasn't given you the highest. But anyone who actually knows the highest sees that it's all in Prabhupada's books. So then it's a matter of where you emphasize like that. So we hope that the devotees will excuse us for overemphasis on these aspects. Any other questions on this related? What time is it then?
2 minutes to 6:30.
Uh-huh. I see. Because it's kind of, whoa, it's late to start on this. But any other general questions on?
Reggie was talking earlier about social pressure.
Oh, that's an interesting point.
We see often that older devotees have fallen into a particular role of service, and they have a desire to, like, tone that down a little bit and do other things, but the pressure is on them to stay in management, to do so many things that they seem to be good at and experienced at. Should they attempt to sort of step out of that gracefully, or they should see it as a duty, or how should they relate to that?
Generally we see is like, you know, Prabhupada was always trying to step out because it's the next generation that come up, they should be able to take it. The younger generations are very, you know, they have a lot of energy, good health, and you know, fresh ideas, and if they're trained in the principles and that, then they can go on. But that works nicely if the next generation is trained. Therefore, if the emphasis of these senior persons is on training the next generations rather than just managing, you manage, but in the managing you train, then it becomes, then it can naturally be turned over. You know, that's there. But the interesting thing is that so many, I mean, it's like, I hear devotees talk so much about, you know, the, you know, whatever it is, so many of the leaders in society are so attached to the positions and the power and influence. Somehow or another, in just my talking with so many of these leaders, I don't find that. I find that there's much more of that on the levels down from the very top. So many of them just would love to get out of management, but they just do it out of a duty. And then what adds even more fun to it is then devotees on that next rungs down or something like that, or the bottom, then they criticize the ones in the top. So it becomes a very interesting circus. But the point is training the next generations to take up. That's the normal thing that would be there. Is that you find those who can deal and all that and train them and let them run things. And then one can step back to some degree. So how much they do, that much you step back. They can do 80%, then 20% can be stepped back. If they do 20%, then that much you can step back. 80% you have to do. If they do 80%, then you only have to do 20%. Because what's lacking is that leadership and training, and the philosophy and example of that. You know, devotees are looking for examples, you know, ideal character and examples in that. But then they have to let the people who have those work in those positions. You know? So it's a balance. It's a great balance. You know? But before it was much more emphasis was on that. I remember when I came to India for the festival in 1974. And then we drove from our temple to New York, where all the devotees were coming. And then I remember a couple of days we were in New York temple while everybody showed up to go. Then all that was happening was this between the temple programs. Then you'd sit around here and there, and different senior devotees would just be, you know, talking on something or reading something. They would be reading a book, everyone else would come sit around because they wanted to hear. And then they would just start discussions. You know, someone's discussing Nectar Devotion, someone Gita, someone this and that. We were driving in the bus going to the airport, then, you know, there's discussions going on the airplane, and there were stories and kirtans and all that. And at the festival, then during the day, you know, everybody would go down to the Ganga, take bath, and then there was always so many classes going on in the bank of the Ganga. So you didn't have to organize seminars, it just automatically happened because everybody wanted to hear and everybody wanted to speak. And the kirtans, everybody went to the morning kirtans and the evening kirtans, you know, there was, everybody was there. Because no one had any, you know, politics to discuss. There was no real interest in that. Like that. And it was very, very nice festivals. Like that. So the emphasis was on that sadhu sangha and all those kind of things. Well, now it becomes more just on management, and you don't have the examples of just hearing, chanting, kirtan. Like that. That's not thought of as a leader. You know, leader is just a good, basically a good bureaucrat. Nowadays, that's the ideal, good bureaucrat. You know, they have a computer, they have a modem, they answer their email, they show up for their committee meetings. Like that, but previously, when Prabhupada was here, leader meant someone who could inspire in philosophy, kirtan, you know, personal example, you know, like, what's his name, Jayananda. You know, just so, I remember he was there in San Francisco. He was there in 70, we also went, that was 73, we went to San Francisco Rath Yatra. Remember, we were there. He was personally there seeing that everyone was getting ready for Mangal Arati. You know, we had one shower for I don't know how many hundreds of devotees like that. He would stand next to the shower and, you know, just see that everybody got in and out quickly and those kind of things. And, you know, fix the Roth cart and devotees would go along with him. And So whatever you were doing, you went into the kitchen and helped there, then, you know, they were making sure that you were being Krishna conscious, and don't talk to Jalpa, and don't get lusty, and, you know, like that. So it was more, that mood of pranipata was very prominent, you know, desiring to learn. And then from that, then naturally pariprasana was there. And then there was naturally seva. But, you know, but then with time, the emphasis was just on service, you know. If you're chanting or reading, then it's like, you know, it's like, well, what are you chanting for, Prabhu? You're chanting for service, so do the service. So that's okay if it's an emergency. If it's a regular thing, then even just, you know, regular chanting or reading. Reading wasn't allowed, you know, because you had more important service to do. So then, like this, is then. So many of the persons who complain, you know, bitterly about the social situation of society were the very same people who before didn't promote reading, you know, which Prabhupada talked about so much. And then now, it's a mess. But naturally, it's always someone else's fault, you know, because in the Western system, fault comes from something gross. Some fault comes from something I can see. While the Vedic is fault comes from something subtle. You know? If something gross is happening, there's something subtle behind it that made it happen. So therefore Prabhupada would talk on the subtle. And devotees don't have faith in that. You know? You say, okay, devotees have problem with, you know, the gurus and the position and following and reinitiation. So you just bring out the point of Prabhupada, the founder, Acharya, the siksha is the main element, the diksha side is subordinate to that, and this and that. Most devotees will say, well, that won't solve it. You know, we need some resolutions, we need some management, we need some like this. That's the thing. It won't solve the problem. The problem is solved by resolutions. Yes, Mati?
I wanted to hear maybe from you what your vision would be, where do we go from here if we have made a mess of it, and what would you, I mean, you must have thought about it a lot in the toilet and out.
Yes.
Over what, you know, what, okay, we're in a mess. What do we do now, really? We all should just back up and sit down and spend more time hearing and chanting and see what happens from there.
Basically, generally, to solve a problem means, or like a disease or anything, then you have to recognize it's there. It means half of your problem is solved by recognizing it's there. If you don't recognize it, you can't do anything. So main thing is, just from what I can see, is just Prabhupada's point of training. Because he felt at one point, okay, we've expanded the society nicely, now let us train. Let us boil the milk. So that means raise the standards, get everyone fixed in those standards, understand why they're doing it. You know, deepen the study and understanding. Because the first thing, if you want to establish social culture, you must have Brahmins. And that means devotees who actually understand the philosophy and can live it and can help others understand it. Then from there, then you can establish managers. And then the managers can get the rest of it done. So it has to start with creating a class of Brahmins. And Prabhupada says that again and again and again and again. Unless you create Brahmins and Brahminical culture, you can't establish Daiva Varnashram. Because Brahmins, they know, but they want Kshatriyas to get it done. So then they will advise people who can get it done. But those people who get it done are trained in the same way. A Kshatriya knows what the Brahmin knows, but he has a practical side. So he works in the same way as Brahmins. Like that. Good Kshatriyas, that's why they're called Rajarshis. You don't see much difference between the great kings and the Brahmins. Just that they're comfortable working in that field of passion. But their mood in dealing in it is goodness. Like that. And then the Brahmins, then it's goodness. And then those who can understand the field of you know, the social, then they advise. But they only advise. The king gets, this is the difficulty, is that the modern thing is you advise, means who gave the advice should get the credit. But in the Vedic thing, who gets the gives the advice, so the Brahmins don't get the credit, not in the people's eyes. The person who got it done gets the credit. Everyone looks at the king. The kingdom is run so nicely because they're a great king. But the king knows he's running nicely because he has good Brahmins. So everyone talks about Vikramaditya. You don't hear about his Brahmins. You only hear about his Brahmins' relationship to him. He was great because he had great Brahmins. Right? Like that. And then the example of establishing proper social order, we see Chanakya. He was a Brahmin. He saw that the kingdom was not being run properly. So then he, first thing he did, because he's already a Brahmin, he looked for a king. He found a king, he trained him. Then after training him, then he established him on the throne. Then he stayed with him long enough to see that he was properly running everything and was trained up. You know, then he left. But it's the credit goes to the king. You know, we think of Chanakya is a great, you know, politician and knower of the shastras of you know, the management. But Chandragupta is known as the king, the emperor. He's actually established it, running the whole kingdom and everything like that, and, you know, ran a very nice kingdom. So that's the thing, is the Brahmins, they'll speak, but then it's the king makes it, because he's the one that has to take the responsibility. So the credit goes to him. He made the right decision. He carried it out. The problem nowadays is the Brahmin wants to advise and he wants to get in the way of the Kshatriya while they manage, and then he wants to take the credit afterwards also. You know, so how is the Kshatriya going to be inspired? He knows if you know how to get it done, do it yourself. You know, that's it. Then do it yourself. You got a big mouth? Okay, do it. Go for it. It won't happen. It won't happen. But they explain, the Kshatriya says, okay, this is good. Then they take it, they do it. And then they get the credit. But then the Kshatriya will tell the Brahmin that, yes, your idea worked very good. But that's between them. It's a private thing. Because they discussed in private, so the appreciation is done in private. You know, the king did the activity publicly, he gets the credit publicly. It's very simple. But somehow, as we mentioned before, the Western mentality is they want everything, you know. As we said, they want the cake, they want to eat it, they want to invest it and make profit off of there. They want to give it in charity and get the, you know, profit of that. And, you know, they say, you know, when they take it to the prize show and get the, you know, profit, get the prize for the best cake. And, you know, it's just they want everything. They're unscrupulous.
When we talk about training Brahmins, Maharaj, it seems that from a lot of what we hear around us at the moment, the essence is lost of the importance of what Brahman means. And that is that the essential feature for me is that their values are the same as Krishna's. They want what Krishna wants.
Yeah.
Like a Sudra wants what's easiest. He considers what's best, what is easiest to do. I'm seeing that with these workers. You know, and different Vaishyas will have a different idea of what is best, but for a Brahmin, the importance of the Brahmin is that the Brahmin understands that what is best is what Krishna wants.
Yeah. Brahmins and Kshatriyas work according to Shastra. They'll never compromise the Shastra. Mm. Though they try to find what is the most practical application. Mm. But it always has to be backed up by Shastra. Otherwise they just can't sleep. They cannot work if it's not based on Shastra. Mm. While the Vaishnava Shudra can work very comfortably without it being based on Shastra, just as long as it makes profit or you know, supports their sentiment. It's interesting. Sahotra Maharaj was telling me about a book. It's very, just side point, very interesting that there are Western intellectuals who know all what's wrong with the Western culture and can point it out, but they just don't know what the solution is. It means they've written books that they have zero faith in how the Western culture is going. Like that. Actually, it's amazing. Devotees have more faith in it than the Western karmis do. Like that. So one book was theirs pointing out that up to, like, the Egyptian culture, you know, up to about 1000 BC, then the whole thing was run by the Brahmins and Kshatriyas. you know, the kings and the priests. And everything was based on ritual and all that. But it had become so external. And they didn't have the high qualities that they were supposed to manifest. So then those below, the bourgeois and that, then they started to get dissatisfied and basically kind of displaced that importance. So they became prominent. And then he was pointing out that the Vaishya values is everything in numbers. Numbers, profit, and this and that. And, you know, like how many you have, how many of this, how many of that, and that. And then for the Shudra, then it was their power, or how something works. It mechanically functions. Or it's how much power you have behind something, like a big army or something like that. So everything was just seen in relationship to numbers and power. And you see the modern thing is it's called hard science, what you can break down in numbers. You know, so physics and mathematics, all these like hard sciences, well, things with the mind and this and that, they're not considered important. So even the top intellectual aspects is still based on the paradigm, the Shudra and Vaishya paradigm of just numbers and power. You know? And that's what's there. We got this many people behind us, and so many people are saying this because, you know, there's so many hits on this particular website. So then we have power, right? Because that's the Shudra mentality. You know, Shudra, the Vaishya mentality. We got power because of numbers. And that's it. That's democracy. It's numbers. You know, the power comes from numbers. So this person was writing and showing how that came, and then that got worse than in the more prominent than in the Renaissance. Then the bourgeois came up even more. They completely threw out the kings like that. So now it's like, you know, how much profit is there, how much money you made, and you know, so that's the thing, you know, number of deities you have in your temple, so it's better, you know, like that, or you know, stuff like that. That's all. You know, number of books that went out. If it was actually the preaching was the essential point, then why did we fry out, you know, like, you know, so many yatras fried out the people, the karmis in that area? Because preaching wasn't the important thing. It was the number of books that went out so that you could say, yes, we're successful. Someone would say, well, Prabhupada says you can judge by how many books are distributed, how many devotees you make.
How many temples you open.
Yeah. So that could be done, but that's based on the principles of preaching that Prabhupada gave. He didn't say that you go out and you completely fry out a person but get money out of them and say, now I've sold a book. That wasn't Prabhupada's mood. Prabhupada's mood is they're taking the book, he explains it, you going to them and giving them the book, because you're giving them such a wonderful thing, they're reciprocating by giving money. So that's the dati pratigrihati. So that's the Brahman. Like that. We see, we go, like Prabhupada expected devotees to go out dressed as devotees and sell books. You know, if they're going to wear kami clothes, okay, then wear tilak. So the whole machinery that just brought in the big scores that then basically brought down the book distribution at one point, that wasn't basically what Prabhupada was talking about. But it's still based on that whole paradigm. You know? So the subtleties of the culture that Prabhupada was giving, you know, the devotional culture and going out there and what we're giving to people and changing them, right? Prabhupada went to a place, he went to, you know, like very the most conservative, like, I mean, if you look at the pictures of what people dressed like and everything in that time when Prabhupada went there, I mean, it just like rabidly, you know, kind of like is caught up in the ego of their the best and most wonderful and the top culture and everything, you know. It's like the pinnacle, like the post-World War II mentality. But then, at the time, then people started to see that this is crazy. It's so superficial. And that started up the countercultures, you know. It was already starting before, the bohemians, the beatniks, like that, but then it came out as the hippies. But they were looking for an alternative culture. They were saying, this is crazy. Like this. So he went there to change them. His godbrother said, you'll have to learn to eat with a fork and knife. And he says, no, I'm going to go there and teach them to eat with their fingers. You know, I'm going to teach, I'm not going to wear a three-piece suit. I'm going to teach them to wear dhotis and saris. So that was Prabhupada's mood. And then based on that, you expand. This way you sell books. This way you open temples. This way you make devotees. So then it just turned into how to just get people in, how to get this and that. But then it wasn't sustainable. Why? Because the essential point, the Bhagavad aspect of it, and the other cultural aspects that Prabhupada gave, then weren't being followed. So then naturally it's not sustainable because it doesn't give satisfaction. One won't do something that one doesn't get satisfaction from. Performing one's duty nicely, one gets satisfaction. If one doesn't perform it nicely, one's not satisfied.
It's been a nice story from Ramachandra Prabhu's time. When it was marathon time and Prabhupada called up, they'd done very, very well in book distribution. And Prabhupada called up all the big timers in his room. And they're expecting some clap on the back or something. And he called them up and he was very quiet. He didn't have much to say to them. And then Ramachandra Prabhu started talking about, we did this and we did that and we did this. And still Prabhupada was quiet. And then things became a little bit embarrassed in the assembly of the devotees.
Mm-hmm.
And then Prabhupada said, when you can bring someone to live in the temple with you for 2 days, and they can stay with you and do what you do, and then they decide that they want to live with you and they want to do what you're doing, that's book distribution.
Because it's, sometimes we forget is that the book, point is we take it simply the book being sold is distributing the book. But then you have to distribute the contents of the book. That means you have to live the contents. You know, so then that would be what's there, is that the book distributors are reading the books, following the books, and naturally when people come to the temple, or they'll be inspired to come because they see something different. You know? Otherwise, you know, it was like people at the airports would see devotees and they just walk the other way. Because they didn't see any qualities that they had any interest in. Well, in the early days, you know, they'd see, you know, where are you? It's just like, was it one interesting? I forget who it was. It was Shyamasundara, Mukunda, whoever was the first one to meet the Beatles. He somehow or another got into the waiting room and this and that, and then, you know, put in, and then at one point, then one of them walked out, you know, and then came and sat down out there in the waiting thing, you know, and sat in the chair and says, hey, we've been waiting for you guys for years. You know, how come it took you so long to get here? You know, like that, you know, we just, they wanted to know about us because they'd seen us and it was just so different and unique, you know, a bunch of bald-headed people in their mother's bed sheets wearing different colored socks, but they were totally in ecstasy, you know, they wanted to know what's going on, you know, like that. So it's, you know. It's a very serious thing. It's interesting. It's, I don't know if I mentioned it. Yeah. But it's all based on faith. Faith is there, then everything works. Faith is not there, then the rest of the process doesn't work. From faith, then all the other aspects of the process are there. Only if there's faith, then you have the other aspects of, you know, sadhu sangha, bhajana kriya, nishtha, ruchi, all that. If there's no faith, none of those are there.
So actually it's more important to give someone faith and not to break it rather than to give them knowledge.
Yeah. The purpose of knowledge is just to develop faith.
Mm.
It means by the knowledge we see the material world is not a place of satisfaction. So we lose faith in the material world. And we see that Krishna and serving Krishna and so many others have served Krishna and they've been protected and been happy and been satisfied and perfected their life, and then that attracts us, and then that aspect, and then that develops faith, and then when we hear about Krishna and Krishna's pastimes and all that, then we become attracted. But we can only become attracted there when we give up on this side. So knowledge is for the purpose of basically burning up our material attachments, you know, and turning our attention to Krishna, focusing on Krishna. That's the purpose of the knowledge, is just to develop that kind of faith. Otherwise, it doesn't have any purpose. Yeah, because that's jnana and vairag means knowledge about Krishna, and vairag is detachment from the material world. You know? So you become detached from the material world by understanding what it is and then seeing it practically. So that. I don't know if it answered them. The question is that one establish the culture as Prabhupada gives. We have to work on properly establishing the Brahminical culture and training, because the whole thing comes from training. Like that is that the training in the Vedic principles, culture, and philosophy has to be there for anybody who's leading in the society. You know, and then that has to be established, and then from those, then who can manage based on those principles, then they can naturally take their place, and that will become. And once that's in place, everything else will happen automatically. You know, because they know how to manage, so they'll be able to do it. But that's how it starts. But for everybody in general, it's just themselves taking and studying and trying to practice what Prabhupada gives them, like that. Because it always starts from the individual. You know, individual. A culture is made up of a group of basically individuals who have the same values, and that's basically the definition of community. It's individuals that have grouped together because of common values, like that. I mean, if you look at any like academic definition of community, that's what it is. So there must be the common training in the philosophy. So it all starts in training. That's why the first stage in life is brahmacharya, because you're trained. Then once you're trained, then you can actually be part of the society. The brahmacharya is technically not part of the society. The overall picture of the running of society, he is, but in the actual society dealings, he's still being trained, technically. You know? But in the realm of how you say, temple, preaching, deities, that kind of activities, they can be very much involved because that's all part of their training. That's what they would do anyway. But in the bigger social management and all that, generally not so much. You know, especially if they're like a second generation, you know, until they finish their training and that, then maybe they can do. First generation, you know, has generally been through the mill, so they have a little idea of what's going on. Then if they get some philosophical backing. But otherwise, technically, they wouldn't be so much. But then the grihasthas would have been those who went through that kind of first-class training. So then they would know how to deal with the brahmacharis, how to deal with the other grihasthas, and how to respect the vanaprasthas and sannyasis. Yeah. Does that make some sense? Or? Does that answer your question? Mm-hmm. Anything else? Or?
I would like to get some training in Vedic culture. Actually, my intention to come to Mayapur is to learn something about Vedic culture, and I would like to also learn something about Indian music. So I'm looking for some opportunities. I'm trying to read Srila Prabhupada's book as much as possible, and I see that your lectures are also very helpful. But I'm lacking association of older Matajis.
Mm.
So I would like to have some kind of training. Is it possible to get some kind of training here?
That seems, I mean, we're doing here whatever we can by running these kind of classes. That's our position. But then depending upon what specific area you want, then you should try to find those devotees that do that or can give some example or give some direction. The important thing is that in training you gain that aspect of training from someone who has it. But don't expect that you're going to get everything in one place. That can be sometimes a source of
frustration
and also sometimes losing of faith in that, because we somehow or another expect we'll find that one ideal person who will teach us everything. But you get what you can from whoever you can. You know, those who have, you know, successful marriages and, you know, nice kids and that, from them you gain those aspects. From someone else who is good in the sadhana and that, you gain those aspects. You know, whatever is the aspect that you're looking for, then you try to gain that from them. If you try to find it all in one place, then that would be very difficult. You know, the only place you find it basically all in one place is in the, you know, Bhagavatam. You know, there then you get all the examples and all the... So you just have to start, the individuals have to want that, study that, and then associate in those places they feel that they're getting what they're looking for. And don't worry if it's not a big group of people, you know, like that. Because it's the quality of association, not the necessarily quantity or, you know, as we said before, the numbers. Naturally, that will grow. The more devotees that think in this way, then the more that will become prominent. You know. Does that make some sense? Or?
Yeah. Did I understand this right, that you said it's important to have a Shiksha Guru physically present? Is that important for that?
Shiksha Guru means is... See, is Shiksha Guru is means the definitely by definition, it is, you know, where we're gaining instruction from. So that can be generally many, many. It's not restricted to one. There must be a person or persons who we are taking instruction from that we are then trying to apply that in our life. So that gives us inspiration and gives us, you know, some direction. Otherwise, we have a tendency, if we're left on our own, to get nothing done. You know, like you'll find, let's say you have some days or you don't have any particular service. There's no obligation to do anything, you know, and then by the time the sun goes down, you have rounds left. You know, even though you could have chanted, you know, 2 lakhs by that time, you can't even get 16 done because there's no specific obligation. So then when we have that direction, we study Prabhupada's books, so we get the Shiksha from Prabhupada, and then we know we should do this, we try to apply this, then we take also advantage of others, you know, whatever they can inspire and give. Because the point is, the culture is very big, individuals are so broad that it takes a, you know, a large amount of community actually to get all these different aspects of inspiration and that. So we get different things from different persons. And then we take advantage of whatever we can from those persons. So that kind of thing is what we mean by that Shiksha must be there. But Shiksha by nature is always alive. You know, it's like we read Prabhupada's books, you know, his books will be around for some time, you know. So even after hundreds of thousands of years, you can still read them. And we can still read, means what the words that Krishna spoke to Brahma, you know, that was at the beginning of the creation. We can read them today and get inspiration from. You know, like that. So that instruction is always there, the Acharya and the previous Acharyas. And then we supplement that with those who are present, who we can go to, we can hear from, you know, either personally or from a distance. It means we come in contact with the instruction. The physical presence isn't so important. So we may hear, we may see, we may have tapes, whatever it is. But there's just some way we should keep ourselves inspired by instruction.
So it's not so important to have one guru that you worship and...
That aspect is there. That's generally the root. Of the Siksha Gurus, means the founder Acharya, who's the, you know, preeminent Siksha Guru, then he is there, he is worshipped every day by everyone in the society. Then we have all those gurus, you know, that give that support to understanding Prabhupada's teachings. And then from that, one is prominent in that they give diksha. So that ritualistic worship is generally afforded to them, you know, as a regular activity in the devotee's life. You know, even if it's very simple, but just that remembrance means, what's his name? Vishwanath saying, yes, yes, tri sandhyam. Jayang stuvams tasya, yes, yes, tri sandhyam. At least three times a day I should be remembering. You know, like this, remembering and just what it is, the dedication, what has been given, the gratitude, the order, all these things. So.
That means Vajrayana?
Huh?
That means at the time of Gayatri.
Generally, that would be the times, because those are the times of meditation. You know, Gayatri is there for the guru.
But that's for whoever gives you the inspiration for spiritual life.
That would be like that. But yeah. But in that also is that in the process, devotional process of the conditioned soul, there's also bhajana kriya, which means then of accepting the mantra through the vidhis, and then with that one has the right to worship the deity. So the person who does that, because they've given the right for that kind of ritualistic vidhi, generally they are worshipped, respected through that process. But the most important element is the instructions they give, which are based on what Prabhupada said. And then anyone else who is prominent in our life and the instructions that they give. But that person is given as a root, so that there's some steadiness. It means Prabhupada's the main root. So we judge everything by that, but if the other Siksha Guru is the one who gives diksha, is generally the root. You know, unless they say otherwise, or that, you know, they may say you take advantage of this person or that person, or, you know, listen to the local authorities, or, you know, so whatever may be the direction. And then one takes advantage of the instructions. So the main worship is the instructions. But there is also that formal side, because the conditioned soul is used to activities that give, you know, we're used to performing an activity and it gets a result. But now we're doing those activities for pleasing Krishna. Like that. Krishna never says give up prescribed duties. Just we give up the desire for the fruit. Is that making sense? Or? Anything else? Or? Okay, so we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveda Bhaktivrinda ki, Jainita Gaura Premanandi.
No.
I mean, that's what it's for. The whole point is to create, you know, interest to questions. If that's not created, then there's no real use to the speaking. Like that. It means that's when there's interest, then once there's supposed to be questions.
I'm just not used to talking about Vedic culture that's attached to the old style. Just being emphasized more on spiritual program.
No, but that's our emphasis. Yeah. That is the emphasis. But in that is that outside the out of the spiritual program, we're going to go home and we're going to have the family there and we're going to have our things in our house, and then how are we going to deal with them? Yeah. Point is if devotees want to emphasize that only, then they should greatly reduce that other side. Then there's very little to deal with. That's why Brahmins live very simply.
Yeah.
Brahmins easily could live very wealthily, mm-hmm. but they don't. They choose to live simply because then there's less trouble. It gives them, the more things you have, the more you have to work hard to get money to maintain it. And so rather than do that, they'd rather spend the time studying or in sadhana.
You're seeing this already so much reduced, the sadhana and the reading and everything. I felt like a little, you know, why putting emphasis? Of course I understand the importance, but, you know,
yeah.
bringing up the standard that was brought up first.
Yeah.
First, Vedic goes together.
It goes together. It's just like, because the thing is, it's just like whatever one takes, does, then one has to take the responsibility of that.
Mm-hmm.
Just like if someone wants to get married, then they have to take care of the needs of the, you know, the wife and the facilities that go along with that.
Mm-hmm.
And then in that marriage, one wants to have children, one has to take care of that.
Mm-hmm.
One doesn't want to get into that, or we just chant Hare Krishna, don't have children.
Mm-hmm.
One doesn't want to get into the hall, don't get married.
Mm-hmm.
But if one finds one can do like that, fine. But if one finds one needs the support of those activities, then one should do it, but take the responsibility that goes with it. Prabhupada always talks about it, taking that responsibility. So those are things. It's like once you go through these rules, that's it. You don't talk about it anymore. You know, once you know that, you know, the husband, you know, has to, you know, give the shelter and protection and take care of the needs, you don't have to discuss it anymore. You only repeat it if someone's not doing it. Otherwise, it's something you hear once, twice until it soaks in, and then that's it. And then the rest of the time is all talked about. Philosophy and Krishna consciousness and how to develop and all these kind of things. And, you know, the real goal of life and the real this and that. But then what's happened is then we've thrown out the other. We've mistakenly thrown that out. But that's not what it's just supposed to be. It's done. So we just, you know, like that. So it's like once someone knows, like in cooking, once somebody knows a recipe, they don't have to keep looking at the recipe book. They just do it.
How come then in the old days that devotees naturally accepted when Prabhupada said something like wash your hands or eat with your right hand, not with your left? And we accepted so many things, but showering and clean. But now we don't accept that anymore. What? I mean, we were like really degraded and we came and we accepted it right away. Everyone. There was no exception. All devotees just accepted it, whoever joined, but then no more.
You generally find new yatras are like that.
Yeah.
One is that the experience in the material world is fresh in the mind. And we joined young, so at age especially you'll find, you know, especially 19 through 21, kind of in that area, is like you can take anything you've done before and throw it out and take on anything new.
Mm.
Like that, it's just natural in the mentality. Then faith was very strong, like that, and particularly because of our overemphasis, just because of the neophyte mentality, you know, the natural neophyte mentality that's there, the overemphasis on diksha and not the proper balance of understanding the emphasis on siksha, then faith has been disturbed, because then the persons who gave diksha had problems.
Mm-hmm.
And then the process stops. Well, if it's on siksha, even if somebody has a problem, the siksha remains. You know? I mean, it remains, you know. If it Chutananda gave a good point, and then bloops, the point is still good.
Yeah.
You know? But if, you know, it's like, if, but the emphasis having been so much on the just, the on the vapu instead of on the vani, then when there's a problem with the person, then it's like everything gets thrown out. And even that, we survived quite nicely up until, I think, 87. And then when we actually threw out the, you know, basically the
preaching.
That, the preaching, and also just the leaders of the movement, then even though they may have had fault, but you deal with the leaders in a particular way. Leaders are dealt with by leaders. You know, leaders aren't dealt with by just the general devotees, you know, as if they're equals. And from doing that, then we see that then the faith and authority was destroyed. A little bit of faith was destroyed when, you know, the big gurus went down. But actually, it was more of a bewilderment. The actual destruction is when the GBC was thrown out. From that point, then every new brahmachari knew about everybody. So those who were supposedly trying to reform the movement at that time trained, you know, the new bhaktas in these things, which is not what you do. You know, you don't tell about the intimate details of household life to an 8-year-old kid. It's violence. So not ourselves, you know, just as, because the Western culture doesn't, that's the way Western culture works. It doesn't, that we're not trained in that. So we just, by habit, we just behaved in that way.
Nothing is sacred in the Western culture.
Yeah.
Nothing is sacred.
Yeah, nothing's sacred. Like that. You know, it's like today, you know, the person is, you know, glorified and wonderful, and tomorrow, you know, you see that. You watch the news, you know, the American president. Today, everyone, he's the greatest guy, this, that, and the next day, you know, throw him out. You know, and then a little time later, he's okay, and then, you know, then it's nothing sacred. That's a very good point. So the thing was, is then that aspect of dealing, because that was just the normal kind of dealings, you know, you can read about it in the, you know, your junior high history books, you know, the French Revolution.
You see this, with this Bill Clinton thing that just happened, and the Indians were appalled that the Americans could do that on TV.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, why do you talk like that? I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, if they get right down to it, like they were making this big thing, but it was all political, and then when they got right down to it, then, I think it was the Speaker of the House and then another person who set up the committee for the investigation, they were talking so loud and heavy and you know, I mean, really pushing the point. And then some, you know, how you say, secret agents of the, you know, the White House kind of came up to him and said, hey, we have this little bit of information about your behavior of extramarital, you know, activities, you know, 5 years ago, maybe you'd like to not speak so much, you know? And then they just all resigned. So the only difference was, is, you know, he got caught and the others didn't. You know, so it's just, you know, it's a very, you don't find that in so much in like in Europe, especially
yeah,
continental Europe.
I was just going to say that's the American culture. In Europe, you don't have that so
much. No.
People have more values in life, even family or or religion. They have something that they stick to, you know, for generations.
Yeah.
But Americans are really
they're unique bunch.
Yeah.
They're a very unique bunch. It's America is a melting pot, but to make everything work, you have to get rid of the cultures that they've come from.
That's so why, I believe.
I mean, American culture is what? It's, is it, you know, what it would be nowadays. But I mean, basically, you think American culture is blue jeans, you know, Coca-Cola. They discussed, I think, in the Congress when Coca-Cola changed the flavor of the drink. You know, because that flavor had been there since, you know, the last century. And it was just like, you know, it was just American. And then at one point, because a lot of people were mentioning about something lighter, this and that, they changed the formula. And it came up in Congress that it wasn't proper, it wasn't American. They couldn't do that. So now they call it Coke Classic. Mm-hmm. And then they have the new Diet Coke and the Orange Coke and the Strawberry Coke and all the other crazy.
Satisfying. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
What Prabhupada said, isn't it? Prabhupada
yeah.
said, your problem is you always want to change.
Yeah, yeah.
You never want to just stick to one
yeah.
thing. You always want to change.
Yeah, something that works, you just keep it. Then the problem is, I think it gets boring because they look just at the externals.
Yeah.
It means what's behind it. Yeah, you find that it's so much in America, then you have less in England. Like that, but then when you just cross from England to Maine, in continental Europe, then it's a complete change.
Mm-hmm.
Then when you go from there into East Bloc,
mm-hmm.
very different. I remember once I was talking in Hungary, I was making some points on, you know, what some of the, you know, more vocal ladies out of America were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And those ladies there, they just said, you know, we've heard something about this, but what is it? It doesn't make any sense to us. You know, to them it was like, women's lib didn't make any sense. They're already running the place, so what do they need to be liberated for, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They, from their houses, are running the place. And if you go there, you can see that,
mm-hmm.
you know? Especially Hungary. I mean, you want to get anything done in Hungary, you just ask a lady to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Forget the men.
Well, Prabhupada gave that example one time. He said, a man and a woman was walking there, and he said, just look at them. Who is carrying the money? And the lady was having the money. He said, she's in charge, Prabhupada said.
Yeah.
She's in charge.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the dynamics, you know. You don't like to necessarily talk about the details in mixed company.
Like
you don't want to let out the secrets.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But the point is that they're already running the place.
Yeah.
And Maharaj is explaining today is that they... in the East Bloc, because of so much hardship, I mean, the whole of Europe, but especially East Bloc, so much hardship, then, and the government's always turning up and down, you know, they're controlled by the Turks, and they go out, and they're controlled by the Romans, and they go out, and then they're controlled by the, you know, the Vandals and other things, and then they go out, and then, you know, it's just, so the home is the only place of security.
Mm-hmm.
And if the home isn't tight, then you don't survive. So it's, you know, getting the things, keeping the things, handing them down to the next generations.
Mm-hmm.
So the family unit is very, very tight there. And it's like the men know what they're supposed to do, the women know what they're supposed to do, and everyone just does it. I've also noticed over there is you know, in Europe in general, but especially I've noticed in the East Bloc, is that they each are individuals and they accept each other's individuality.
Mm-hmm.
So wife has her interest, husband has theirs, mm-hmm. and they let each other do it.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't matter. If it's common, fine. If it's not common, it doesn't matter.
Because
mm-hmm. running the house is the common thing.
Mm-hmm.
Raising the children, that's the common thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, cooperating, planning together. It's not that they're both going out surfing together, both going out, no. You know, it's like, you know, one wants to go out with the boys and one wants to hang out with the girl. It doesn't matter. They don't. To them, that's not the togetherness. They accept everybody has their own space, their own like this, and then they just do. And what's actual makes the house work, that's where they work. So it's very, very different. You know, it's more, it's Europeans, but it's the influence of the Asian aspect is prominent there, you know. And as you go down farther, you know, like Bulgaria, Romania, like that, Yugoslavia, Serbia, even more.
And very attached to their religion, too.
Yeah. Because religion is the platform of actual the social culture. Because religion is what establishes what you do, what you don't do. That makes a standard. Maharaj made a very nice point this morning. If you want to measure something, you don't measure it with itself. You measure it with something else.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to measure, you know, social, you know, point, I don't measure it with itself. I measure it with something else. So that something else comes from the scriptures. So I measure what I'm doing and my activities against the scriptures. And nowadays, there isn't that measuring against the scriptures. It's just measuring against. I'm measuring sense gratification against with my senses. Yeah, yeah. So it's you have that, but the sense gratification means it's the sense and the sense object, and I'm measuring that whether that's good or not with the sense. So you can't get anything proper. I have to measure the senses and the sense objects with the higher ruler, you know, of the emotions and the spiritual. You know, it may be great for my senses, but it may not be very good for the family life, you know. You know, the man might be off with some other woman. For the senses, it's, you know, it's great. But as far as the emotional standard and the family, you know, welfare, it's not a good standard. And as far as spiritual life, it's absolutely, you know, useless. So we have to judge these things by what it does for spiritual life. Maharaj is making the point that all these rules and regulations are secondary to the point of it actually enhances spiritual life. We're not interested in following the four regs because it's moral. We're not moralists. We're interested, we follow the four regulated principles because it enhances our spiritual development. So because the higher is there, automatically the lower is there. You know? The emotional exchange between a mother and child automatically means that the senses of the child are going to be taken care of. It just comes without saying. So if you have the spiritual, these are automatically there. So if they're not there, that means that you're not following the spiritual properly. Because the higher automatically has the lower in it. The needs of the lower are already contained in the higher. So if devotees don't get it, they didn't follow the spiritual right. You know, because nowadays talk is someone doesn't follow the regulative principles. It's a moral problem, and it's going to be dealt with morally, and they're going to be reminded of it morally. You know, there's no talk of spiritual.
You know? That's why it changes.
Yeah, it always changes, and that's why you can't get in any one community. Group of devotees. You know. I won't use the word community, then you won't find a common standard. Therefore, I won't use the word community, because community means common value. So you have a group of, that's why I was mentioning before, don't necessarily expect the whole thing will work together. You have to, within the big group of devotees, find those who have common and create your own community. Community is that, when there's common values and common methods of getting those values. So even if you have, you know, two or three families that have that, that's a community. You know, it may not be a big community, but it's community. A community is based on community. You know, that they have that common. Yeah. So it's just a few families that they get together, associate with each other, then they'll be happy. And then it can expand. But if it's like we can't be happy until everybody in the whole place is all, then they better start having some serious, you know, istagostis for many days until there's a consensus. But if that's not happening, then we have to be happy with just finding a few devotees that we do have common interest. And then from there it'll grow. And if not, then at least you have it, right? You know, we come to a place looking for that community spirit. So if we can find a few devotees, then that's enough. Because, you know, in the Western paradigm, you're not going to find it. You know, Western paradigm always talks about it. You know, but, you know, where is it? You know? Where is it? Yeah, because it's religion. Then you come into the Middle East, and then the religion is stronger. You know, I mean, they'll kill each other over just the religion. And then you come to India, and then that's the strongest. You know, like that. So the whole social structure is based off the religious principles. So that's the point. Religion and prescribed duties are synonymous. You know, so the religion is based on the philosophy. So it has to be, the religion has to be subservient to the actual higher principles. You know, that, so it has its place, but that's it. It has a place and that's it. The real life is in the higher, the Bhagavat and the preaching and all that. not sure. I think we got onto so many tangents of tangents. I'm not sure if we answered your question.
If I can go back to the subject, I'm trying to clarify my understanding of the position of the spiritual masters in ISKCON. I understand we've had too much emphasis on just Diksha. We should have respect, appreciation of all the spiritual and Siksha gurus, with Prabhupada as a Pranacharya, Prempriyam, and Siksha guru, everyone. Now I'm a bit confused because just there's talk of, you know, this guru reform. Like, so bringing down, you know, the standard to not like Funacharya, but like a worship like normal guru. And on the other hand, now you're talking of have the respect for the senior devotees and as leaders. And
yeah, because that's normal.
So now, if you get your understanding, please, to help me clarify what is the position of how the guru should be worshipped.
You know? The thing is, this guru is one part of the whole social structure. So senior devotees are worshipped. I mean, when I joined as a devotee, we offered obeisances to everybody in the temple before Mangal Arati. That was first thing. We always offered our obeisances to the temple president whenever we saw them. You know, when, you know, the Mahaprasad and all that went to the temple president. Then if there was a sannyasi there, then the temple president and the devotees in the temple would greet them, wash their feet, and then take care of them. And then when they went, then it went back to the temple president. Anyone who was a Brahmin, you know, they were considered very respectable and all that. So in that's the proper culture. Then within that, then naturally the worship of the guru is balanced. But then somehow or another, at one point, is just respect for the devotees and sannyasi, everything. That all went out the window and we just had respect for the Diksha guru. So it wasn't what Prabhupada had established. And somehow or another, we reduced the broadness of respect. So then people who had been respected before suddenly weren't. You know, like that, you know. So it's point is the balance is there. So when you say normal guru, but we also have to understand normal, I mean, it's just like washing feet. Sudama Brahman goes and visits Krishna and he washes his feet, you know. He's not his guru, he was his god brother. And he's not he wasn't a sannyasi, you know. He was a simple householder. But because he was a Brahmin, so he's a teacher, so Kshatriyas respect Brahmins. But he was his friend, intimate friend. So it wasn't done out in the court, it was done in Krishna's private quarters. Like that. So depending upon the relationship, then that was done. The washing of feet is afforded like this. That's such a common thing in India. Unfortunately, the Westerners like to make a big deal out of it, but it's such a common thing in India. You know, very common. But so it's just a matter of that. Point is respect must be there. There must be a medium through which we show that respect. So culture is generally that medium. We use the culture as a medium. But anything can be a medium. You know, our offering our obeisances and main thing is we're remembering what we're getting from the guru. And then committing ourselves to that instruction and direction. That's the main thing. Right? Then to make that more solid than that maybe offering of flowers, offering of artik, or washing the feet or all those just expand, but that itself does not make the commitment. Otherwise you can see so many, Prabhupada always talks about dandabat disciples. They come in, they offer a million obeisances, but you tell them what to do, they don't do it. So it's like, what's the use? You know? So we can offer big, big respect and big, big worship and then politic with everybody else, and my guru's the best. But it comes to following the order of the guru. You know? Like that. I've seen so many devotees that, you know, it's like they're you know, rabidly fanatic about their guru is the best. And then, you know, one guru died. You know, one of the few that died didn't bloop. And then, you know, some, you know, months or something later, then they all went off with, you know, left the movement and went off with Gaudiya Math. These are the same people that it's, you know, our Guru Maharaj, and it's really unfortunate that you didn't take initiation from our Guru Maharaj, but still you can be fortunate, you can still hear from him, you know, so your life still can be saved, you know. Even though you didn't take initiation from him. like this, same persons when they're out the door. You know, same persons that, you know, make all kinds of guru politics out the door, off here, off there. You know, because, you know, so many things. Because it's only external. They externally did, but they didn't give the heart. So the whole exchange is of the heart. That's what's important. So we have to be very, very careful. Is that what is to be brought out? So the rules and regulations or the external worship brings that out, because the kanista is prakriti. They see matter. So things that happen in matter, they feel something is happening. I offer a lamp to the guru, I think I've done something. I just sit down and think, you know, about what I've gained from the guru, this and that. I don't think much has happened. And there's a good chance I won't even do that. You know, I'm too busy, you know, worrying about when's lunch or something. You know? So these things help focus the mind through a system given by Krishna, you know, the regulations and all that. So it helps focus the mind. But it in itself is not the actual surrender. But many will take that. We had the biggest, we spent the most money, you know, we had the most people, you know, like we mentioned before, back to numbers and power. So then therefore it was successful. Rather than I really, you know, spoke what I felt and thought about it, and, you know, there was a strong exchange, strong realization, strong commitment, that this was the result, you know. You know, so that's the real thing. That's the real worship of Guru. So that aspect has to be seen. So when that's there, then all the other works. You know? Then all the other things work. Because, you know, it's like, how you say? The mood of when Prabhupada was present and the Guru Puja went on, nobody even thought about the Artik. You know, it was just seeing Prabhupada and doing kirtan and, you know, thinking about what he had done and all that kind of thing. The externals weren't the big thing, because at those days the devotees were not at all expert in Pancharatra or all these things. Now, with so many years, then devotees have become much more expert at the process of worship, but in those days they didn't know what was going on. So then, but the exchange was very powerful. So somehow or another along the line, that mood of exchange was lost, and it just got into just the externals. And then because that's all you have, then it's natural, you know, whatever you do today. You know, I mean, when Prabhupada was here, the same artik went on for as long as he was here. Nothing more, you know. Vyasasans were a certain size, and that's all the bigger they were. You know, some of the more elaborate ones were actually quite small. You know, some of the most elaborate, like New York, very elaborate with all lotus flower and like that. I think the Berkeley Asan and that, they're much smaller. And then some of them were a little bigger. Asan just a little bigger. The one that's here now, and that was the one that Prabhupada sat on. Here in Mayapur, they did something else for many years, but then they put this one back. This is the original one that he used to sit on, and that's it. But no one thought that you had to get bigger and it had to be, you know, 50 feet high and 20 feet wide, and just because it just got into that kind of thing, because that's all there was. And then trying to change that from there, then others have, you know, tried to remove that. But then they also don't see that you have to leave something for exchange. You know? It means the principle of the exchange is not understood. So they think that the external is the worship and they want to cut that down. But there has to be some medium for it. The emotional exchange is the most important. But even that, by those who want to reform this, is not being considered. We want to have a strong exchange. What's going to be the medium? How to train devotees in understanding that through a simple medium you can have just as much, if not more, exchange as, because the ritual or the form of it is just to carry that. You know, it's a vehicle for the exchange. You know? So that has to be, if that's understood, then it automatically corrects itself. That's the thing, is if we're by resolution and this and that, that's not how you don't establish culture by that. The resolutions have already been made, right? I mean, the shastras are the resolutions. So it's just a matter of seeing how to best follow those, what applies. You know, you have some places, you know, that there's gurus who don't accept any of these kind of worship. I would say another main obstacle is that the understanding of you know, one simple term, the term absolute, is that if we take the Vedic meaning, then it becomes very applicable to our present situation. And if we take the, you know, if we take the Christian meaning, I won't even leave aside the Judaic, because they don't have this problem. You know, Catholics don't even have the problem. It's basically Protestants. Absolute means, you know, complete, squeaky clean, pure, you know, floating in the sky, you know. And since we're devotees, we put an om sign and a few clouds. No, clouds are there, excuse me, in Christian. Christian, you have the clouds, you just don't have the om sign. So, you know. So therefore, they're not actually dealing with our philosophy. And so, because they're not dealing with our philosophy, when they try to understand absolute, they're not dealing in Krishna consciousness. And then they put their faith in their own mental speculative ideas, and then when things don't go the way they like, then they lose faith, and then they claim that it's the Vedas' fault. But the Vedas say iron and fire. The Vedas don't say that the iron is not iron. They just say when it's in fire, it acts like fire. But if it's out of fire, it acts like iron. Very down to earth. The Vedas are very down to earth. You know? When Ajamiya was a qualified Brahmin, he's a devotee. When he was in that mood, he's respected. When he's out of the fire and he's in sinful activities, we don't hear from him. As soon as he gets back into the fire, then we hear from him. Then he's respectable again. That's simple. But You cannot practice this Vedic form of absolute with an American 100% or zero paradigm. That's a major stumbling block. Because there it's your all or nothing. And once you're nothing, that's it. So because of this, then, you know, so where does the problem lie? Part is in the gurus, but that's also what we made out of them. But more is in our just, you know, not recognizing our own attachments to our own previous cultures, and then being so fanatic about and attached to that. Because you have Indians today, you know, they were initiated by these people. And if you ask them what happened, they say, well, you know, whatever. You know, they either got too many disciples, took on too much karma, so many things like this, and they went away and this and that. They still have respect for them. Because they know that these people picked them up, trained them in Krishna consciousness, you know, gave them an interest in chanting and worshipping deities. And because of that, original inspiration is still going on. But now they know, you know, can't listen to the guy. You know? So their faith in Krishna consciousness in this way doesn't become, because we understand the principle, it's siksha. So we approach someone to get siksha. And naturally a prominent person in this gives us the diksha, because we need the diksha. But the essential element is the siksha. If that person is not there, we still have Prabhupada, because they're only representing Prabhupada. So our relationship with Prabhupada hasn't diminished any. And we have so many other persons that we like to listen to, because when we first joined, we had many people we want to listen to. But then what happened to those persons? Because the overemphasis on diksha, as soon as we take initiation, then those other persons are just like pushed out of the way. Because if we hear from them or have any faith in them, we feel, well, we're unchaste. So then when that one person goes, then what do you have? We haven't put much emphasis on Prabhupada as the founder Acharya. You know, that's something we did as a new bhakta for 6 months. You know? And then all the other people that were, you know, we were inspired by, then we kind of like have not developed those relationships. So when the one goes, we're left with nothing. And then we think, you know, so much emotion, because socially, you know, all our emotions are focused on one place. And then when that goes, then there's great frustration. Well, if we follow the actual system, then Prabhupada's always there as a central feature. And then so many other people are there. And if one goes, you know, it's definitely a great letdown. But it's not the end of the world. Because the siksha is still going on. The essential point of initiation is still going on. We're still hearing from Prabhupada. We're still hearing from these others. Just that that person who has taken specific, responsibility or commitment to help us understand Prabhupada's instruction, go back to Godhead, that's not there. So that naturally has some deep emotional connection, attachment. But the other aspect's still there. So it's unfortunate, but life goes on. This other way, then it's just, you know, they're everything, and everybody else is, you know, nothing. Then that, because it's a kanista mood. So the main problem is in just misunderstanding what is the process. It's not in the worship. It's not in all these things, this and that. You'll find most gurus don't like all the worship. If you actually check all the 85 gurus or whatever is there, you'll find very few accept, you know, any worship. You know? Like that. So that's not main. The other ones took a lot. But that's also, devotees wanted that. You know? So between just that lack of understanding and emphasis on this, these points, Prabhupada is the founder and all these things. That's the main difficulty. The externals are, as we mentioned in the beginning of the class, the externals are a manifestation of what's going on internally. So if we just see the externals, say these externals are wrong, and then try to adjust those, unless we address what's internally wrong, then the results won't be very, very good. You know, result will not be very satisfying. Because subtle turns to gross. So if there's an overemphasis, we find there's an overemphasis on worship of, you know, the Diksha Guru, then what is causing that? What is going on? What's happening? What mechanically is going on? But most devotees, as it is, don't want to even understand other rules. You know, we chant Hare Krishna, we don't care for all these things. But so, because of this, there's a lack of interest in understanding technically how the devotional process works and what's going on. I mean, as it is now, if you use the words Bhagavad Vidhi, Pancharatrika Vidhi, devotees will say, you know, this is not Prabhupada. But that's, you know, where we get the terms from. I mean, there's hundreds of times Prabhupada quotes these words. You know, even the class the other day, used it, you know, Sakam Karma Yoga, Nishkam Karma Yoga. They'll go, this is not Prabhupada. Prabhupada uses it so many times. It just, devotees don't read and aren't aware of technicalities. They don't pick those up, you know. So we have to see technically just what's going on. And then we see it's major problems have been there and this and that, but major problems, it's if it's a problem, generally we see it's because of illusion, of Maya. And Maya is even though it's very big, it's still nothing compared to the holy name and the devotional process. It's So even the biggest problem goes away very easily if there's Krishna consciousness. So the emphasis on if one can train somebody in Krishna consciousness, then so many of these problems naturally go away. So Prabhupada put the emphasis on the training. You know, because Brahminical culture means you're always studying, always improving oneself, always helping train others. Like that. So that's just the natural activities of the devotees. And when that's established nicely, then everything else will come. Does that make any sense? Yes.
And then other day in Bhagavatam class, you concluded, I wasn't exactly sure how I understood, that by not respecting our devotees, actually this was the final point, this was something of just impersonalism. I don't know how. What was the progress from? I don't quite understand.
I'm not, fortunately, never remember what I said.
Oh,
so. But means I was saying we're not dealing with each other on the personal level, because the personal level is, it's a very interesting thing. The personal level is the level of the soul. That's the real person. Now that person has a material misidentification, which then has created the subtle body. Right? They misidentify, that creates a false ego. Then that creates a particular kind of intelligence and mind to do that. That subtle body creates a gross body. So when we say we have to deal with the individual, the modern thing is as far as they'll get is the mind, maximum. Generally, if you look at it, New Age means the senses. Because that's always their conclusion. It's because the senses are being restricted, then there's dissatisfaction. So if you just let the senses go and do what you want, then everything will be all right. So it's impersonal because you're not actually dealing with the personality. You're just dealing with the material energy. You know, and even if they bring it to the point of the emotions, you're still just dealing with material energy. Until you're dealing with the soul. The soul is a person. That's the thing. Is we say, we deal with the soul, and then immediately someone will say, no, but what about, you know, their emotions and their dealing? Just, who's doing all that? It's the soul. So that's the point. Because we're so rooted in impersonalism, we don't understand that the reason that there's all the emotions and the senses, because that's the soul. The soul is ananda. Ananda means relationship and all that. Ananda doesn't mean dry, but that's how we see it. We say the soul. Or if you say something philosophical, that's philosophy. Now what about the reality? You know, what is reality? The reality is Krishna. Everything else is illusion. If anything's in connection with Krishna, then it becomes reality. If it's not in relation to Krishna, it's absolute illusion. It doesn't matter if it makes things work nicely. If it's not done in relation to Krishna, it's illusion. Therefore, knowledge is useful for becoming Krishna conscious, but if that knowledge is not used in Krishna's service, or is not for the purpose of becoming Krishna, it's illusion. Same as activities. If they're done for Krishna, they're a source of elevation. If they're not done for Krishna, they're illusion. Even if it's nice, moral, wonderful, great PR, it's still illusion. If it doesn't actually enhance the soul's development of love of God, it's illusion. That's the bottom line. So when we say reality, then what is reality? Because all this stuff that many devotees talk about nowadays of reality and, you know, what people are into today and, you know, all these different things, all the modern stuff, the talk that goes on, there's just as many books by Western authorities, like, you know, heads of departments at Oxford and other big intellectuals of the world, they just say, this is all crap. They have whole books written on how the Western paradigm as it is now is this crap. You know? And they go back and they show historically and they show all the people that created it. You know? Who were the philosophers? What were the turning points? What everything happened? They just show that the paradigm that's happening now today has no substance at all. Everyone talks substance, but there is no substance. So even from the point of the real world, as devotees like to say, there's even a realer world in that real world that just says this is all nonsense. So it's the whole thing is, you know, what does all this mean? Real means what actually gets results. You know? And so the point is that those results must be based on a goal. You know? If there's social development but no Krishna consciousness, that's illusion. That's maya. It's nonsense. I mean, the devotees of my generation joined because they were frustrated with doing just that. Their parents were nicely situated and, you know, like nice, good middle-class America and were, you know, nose to the grindstone and, you know, ear to the ground and all those nice things and doing the status quo, and they all thought it was, you know, crap. And then they became devotees. Right? Now, 20, 30 years later, then somehow or another, we talk the same things. But just we use new language. That's all. That's the main thing. Was it Orwell called it?
New speak.
Yes, new speak. That's all. I mean, we read about this stuff in seventh grade. New speak. Animal farm. What's the difference? Hostas say, you know, the sannyasis and brahmacharis, they controlled everything, and grihastas suffered, and things like that. Now, grihastas get in charge, what do? They clamp down right on the sannyasis and brahmacharis. It's just, what does it matter? If the farmer's in charge or the pigs are in charge, it's the same thing. You know? Unless you change the paradigm to Krishna consciousness based on the philosophy and the culture that matches that philosophy is given to us by the acharyas, then there's not going to be any different result than the material world. Because the material world is run by the modes. She's the boss. Right? You want to know who's in charge, the men or the women? It's her. Right? She runs things. So that's the option. You either have Krishna or you have Maya. There's nothing else. American dream may think that there is something else, but there's not. You follow Krishna or you have Maya. There's no alternative. Like that. There's nothing in between. There's no, you know, how you say, the best of both worlds. Like that. Because this world there is nothing best. You know, it's like saying, you have the toilet or you have a nice garden. No, we want the best of both. You know? So basically, you know, we just put some air freshener in the toilet and then set up camp in there. Nice, you know, nice shiny white porcelain. Best quality. So we have to be very, very careful in the dealings. Is that the only solution is actually just chanting Hare Krishna. There is no other solution. But because of our conditioned nature, we have to take support from the Pancharatra and the Vedic culture. But those are just that. They're just support for the chanting. That's all. They're just support for the chanting. Otherwise, if there was material, I mean, others have been doing all the things, this and that, they've been doing. What we think is something new now has been going on before. You know, it's just like we thought in the 60s, you know, drugs and drugs came up and that. People have been using, you know, cocaine since the last century. Who's the guy that wrote Alice in Wonderland?
Lewis Carroll.
Yeah, he was a cocaine freak. All the great, all those poets and all that, you know, far heads at that time, they were all cocaine freaks. You know? My father told me that, I asked him about, Walt Disney's Fantasia. I asked him, how did he come up with this, you know? Pink elephants and tutus dancing with crocodiles and all this kind of stuff. And he said, he used to take cocaine. This is before it was ever known. You know, cocaine is some new thing that just hit in the 70s, right? They've been using it for the last over 100 years. We just know about it now in our generation. So all this stuff's been going on. And the Roman Empire went down with drugs and illicit sex and all that kind of stuff. That's when they fell apart. It's been around for, forever. Somehow or another, we think we're so unique and special. Like that whatever we experienced when that was, whatever we did from 12 to 18, that's the world. But if we can, point is it's because the saving grace of the whole thing is because we are spirit soul. And because the acharyas, Lord Chaitanya is so kind and he's sent the acharyas to delineate what is there, the correction of all this is very, very simple. You just have to take it and do it, and that's all. It's no big this and that. It's just a matter. Study the books, try to practice it, try to teach others, and, you know, work out ways that ourselves and others can systematically learn what's in the books and practice and live it. And then it's actually very simple. So there's no need to get in anxiety that it's, you know. Some may say, well, that's oversimplistic or idealistic, but that's why you have to establish Brahmins first, because that's their head. That's why they're the leaders of society, because they have that kind of head. And all the others that get all worried about this and that and been out of shape about, you know, these other things, they're supposed to follow that. You know? Otherwise, the perfect social development's an animal, right? You don't need a house, right? It rains, you just sit there, you know? You're waterproof. You know? You need something to eat, it's growing on the ground. The grass is right there, you just eat it. You know? You just have to watch out for, you know, tigers and those such things like that. You know? You don't need to go to school. No problem with that kind of stuff. That. Whoever's got the biggest antlers and that is the king. Like that. So everybody has equal opportunity, they can give it a try. You know? Like that. So I mean that's perfect. We take that way. So the other is that we have to take Krishna's way. So it's a big science. But it starts from just studying it, learning it, practicing it. And we see, even just knowing just the basics, you can run very nicely. The Prabhupada's here, the enthusiastic and everything, that was there. But the devotees weren't very expert. At least the essence was there. So that's the point, is you start from the essence. You start from establishing the Bhagavat. Then you come the essence of that, then that expands, right? Then you establish the essence of the Pancharatra, and then that expands. And then the essence of the Vedic, and then that expands. So Prabhupada did that on all those levels. And he expanded it, And if you want to know more technical details, then he told what books to read. You want to know more on the Vedic? He said Manusamhita, Yajnavalkya, and Parasa. You know, he's already specifically pointed out of 20 main Dharma Shastras, he said these three. These are ours. The Hari Bhakti Vilas is there. And the Pancharatra. Narada Pancharatra. That's there. And then for the Bhagavat, then Srimad Bhagavatam, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Bhagavad Gita, commentaries of the Acharyas, and the books of the Acharyas. So like that, we can know very, very nicely. It's just a matter of taking that and doing it. We always must remember is that you're going to influence the gross by influencing the subtle. You influence the consciousness, that influences the subtle body. The subtle body influences the gross body. So therefore, if you really want practical, down-to-earth stuff, you have to do those things which influence the consciousness. Consciousness changes automatically. If you have people whose consciousness is fixed on the Lord, he's a devotee, they respect other devotees because of their relationship with the Lord, then what is the need of, great rules, a bunch of rules and regulations to keep each other from killing each other? Right? Therefore, the Paramahamsas don't need any rules. As you drop down, then they need some more rules. But they don't need the rules. Does that make any sense? Or? So what Prabhupada has given, the system he has given, it's a perfect system. We study these books and we follow these books. And then it works very nice. Start from there, expand. So that was the thing. The Brahmins understand this. They can teach this. Kshatriyas means they can understand this and apply it. To the social scene. Like that. Is that okay? Too strong.
The next one thing would be speak about how we should understand or appreciate our full nature, like where we are. Now, how do we know what is our prescribed duty from that position?
That we've discussed many times before. But just basically, as we see, just in a nutshell, very simply, is that. Is generally one starts from the platform of brahmachari, and then one gets trained properly in those points that Prabhupada says, It means Narad Muni describes, the service attitude, the cleanliness, respect for authority, knowledge of the scriptures, sense control, these things, they practice that. When that's there, then if they find that with that they can go on very nicely in their life, they're satisfied, they remain as brahmacharis. Or Bhaktisiddhanta says, Swati Thakur says, they can go from there into sannyas. No need to go through Grihastha and Vanaprastha. If they find that they understand that, but there's still some emotional attachments, just from so many lifetimes of habit, then they get married. And then in the marriage life, they continue now that study that they did by practically applying it. And then they see what they studied, how it's true. Then they see that what they're looking for is not actually in the Grihastha Ashram, but it's the devotional activities. That's why everything continues. There's sadhana and there are devotional activities, so they add now the particular occupational duties of grihastha. But they see that that's not actually what gives the satisfaction. But they perform those duties properly, because those are Krishna's rules, like that. And then from that proper performance of that duty, they get realization, they get knowledge. You know, the realization. And then from there, then one moves into vanaprastha. And then if the time or the, how you say, nature is there, then sannyas. And then the brahminical activities means the culture is everybody's brahminical, but you have the conditioned nature that has a specific quality in Brahma, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra. So then one just sees if the, you know, the preaching, the teaching, deity worship, you know, this kind of things where you're dealing with the shastras and all that, that is the main element, then one would be satisfied in those activities. You know, if based on those the shastric principles, one has an ability to organize devotees and create facility for them and give shelter and see that, you know, justice and everything is working smoothly together and standards are being maintained. Brahmins are being Brahmins, Kshatriyas are being Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, Vaishyas, Shudras, Shudras. I mean, everybody's doing their duties properly. Then one does that. And if one has ability in business and one has that proclivity that you can give them some money and you know, they can just get something and start business, or even if they blow it that time, then they figure out what's wrong and then improve that, you know, next time. You know, like that, but they progress and they don't lose their faith in that and they actually then get it in the Vaishyas. You know, if they have the Vaishya mentality but they can't get money, then, you know, they should just be gophers. You know, do, you know, work in the community and do short-term result-oriented activities. You know, and then if they don't have any of those three mentalities, then they just assist those three. So it becomes very easy to see. But sometimes the ease is frightening to most devotees. You know, mostly because the Western, you know, the living entity is so worried about prestige and position, and especially the Western about control, you know, control, power, wealth, facility, that they're afraid if where they position themselves, they may not be in the best. You know, so therefore they want all of them. That's the main obstacle to kind of like just having the social system work, is everybody wants everything, you know. You want to advise everybody on the cosmic creation. You want to have, you know, full influence and power, but no responsibility, you know. We want to give all advice and everything, but we don't want to base it on the shastra, you know. We want all the wealth and all that, but we don't want to give in charity. And, you know, we want to be taken care of by others and given all facility, but we don't want to have to, you know, follow them, their direction, and, you know, like that. So it becomes very difficult. Okay? Yes? No?
I was thinking of Sakam Kama Yoga. Now, is that... That seemed to come to fall in grihastha ashram in my mind because they work and enjoy the food school.
Can.
Or is it general?
It's general, but specifically Sakam is... mainly means grihastha grihastha would be neophyte. Sakam, general kind of description would mean... you're doing the activity you like for the the result that it gives. And then that result then is at least in part given to Krishna. Nishkam is that one's not interested in the fruit. Though because of the conditioned nature, there may be a particular attachment to doing a particular kind of service for Krishna. But you're doing it for Krishna, how Krishna says it should be done. And the fruit is His. But there's still attachment to that nature, you know, because the conditioned nature is there. That's why it's still called karma misra. Sakam is called karma misra. Nishkam is called jnana misra. So it's not considered pure, unalloyed devotional service. But it still falls within the realm. If the motive is to develop pure love for Krishna, it's still called pure devotional service. But not pure unalloyed, because there's still some mix like that. But that the point is it doesn't really matter if it's done for Krishna. Point is if we have attachments that lead us into grihastha life, as long as we do those for Krishna, then it's also sat. Krishna says anything in relation to Him is sat. But we understand that we're trying to engage those things in Krishna's service. So those desires are there, so we engage them. And then by engaging in Krishna's service, they'll be burnt up. So the whole point is that in the life, at some point, you know, especially before the end of it, we try to get rid of, you know, ideally all the material desires and attach ourselves to Krishna. If not, we get rid of as many as we can, because then that's where we'll carry on in the next life. So if you've gotten rid of most of them, then next you'll carry on from that. So it doesn't matter. That's the thing, is that we get too much caught up in the external. So Prabhupada would say, first-class man wouldn't get married. That's because he's heard and he's realized. Second-class hears, understands, but doesn't realize, therefore he gets married. Like that. So it's not considered as good. But as long as one does that, gets married for the purpose of realizing, the result is then one comes to that first-class platform. Just one just spent more time getting to that place. That's all. But at least it's done. So the point is whether you get to that platform today or tomorrow, one has to endeavor to get to that platform. So that's the thing, is you see the reality of what position I'm in today. What is my position? What are my desires, my needs, this and that? And then move within that. Don't try to artificially go to the next level up, or we might fall back. And when we fall back, we generally fall lower than the position we were at before making that jump. So therefore, we're steady in that, and when that's steady, then we gradually move into the next step, like that. You know, just like one has faith. But if one prematurely moves into, you know, sadhu sangha, and just, you know, gives up whatever one was doing before and moves into that, maybe premature, and after a short time one leaves. So one has to see by that gradual association one's ready for that more solid association. Then one sees that one is ready for initiation, otherwise one can jump to that platform, but one might fall back, you know, or leave. Because if the faith becomes disturbed, then the position one's on is not solid, it becomes anishta. And from there one may fall from that. So then you're in a platform lower than when one first gained that faith. Like that. So it's when the faith becomes reduced, it's very dangerous. So one should always try to maintain the understanding and keep the association that keeps the faith up. One may be a little bewildered about some application or directions or that, but the faith should be there that the process is perfect, Prabhupada is perfect, his instructions are perfect, Krishna consciousness is perfect, you know, Krishna is perfect, everything about him is perfect, just I don't quite understand how to apply it, or maybe around me not everybody understands, but you know, if we just work at it and try to sincerely follow what Prabhupada gives us, it'll work out, you know. Because external perfection is not what takes one back to Godhead. Right? if someone can do that nicely, that's called sadhana siddha. But if one doesn't, but the sincerity is there, that's called kripa siddha. So Narottam Das Thakur recommends kripa siddha. You endeavor to follow everything nicely, but the main emphasis is on trying to surrender and please Krishna. You know, because if the following the rules doesn't come very nicely, Gopal Bhatta Goswami mentions that he gives in the taking of sannyas, that there's those who the qualities of sannyas come naturally, and there's one name for that. I don't remember the name. It's right here. And then another is that who he has to practice it and work at it, and then he gets it. And that's a different name. So whichever it is, so if it comes naturally, that means one's already worked at it previously. And one is just taking up where one left off. And if one has to work at it, means one hasn't done it, but at least one's gotten up to that platform. Yeah, one who is qualified may possess the qualifications naturally, vidvat sannyasi, or one may attain the qualities through initiation and the process of regulated devotional service, vivatsa sannyasi. Like that. So if they're there naturally, then that means that one has purified oneself up to that platform. And if not, then by following devotional service, they'll come. Because the point is all these high qualities and everything are natural to the soul. You know? I mean, many of the great sannyasis in that, you know, are line. They're all gopis in the spiritual world. You know, or others from there. So it's not that. It's just that they're naturally detached from the material world and attached to Krishna. So then these kind of, you know, that kind of dharma is very natural for them. So some come to set example like that. Some just come along, and because they're in the Lord's pastimes, they just do the things they do in the spiritual world. You know? So many times you see our acharyas, they come like that also. Because in the spiritual world, in Vrindavan, everybody's Vaishyas. Right? There's a few Brahmins like that. You know, Madhu Mangal and his sister and Purnamasi, and like that. They're the prominent Brahmins there. And then there's some Brahmins that are always chanting mantras, doing yagyas and all that, that creates an atmosphere. But you don't hear about them much in the pastimes. So they're all Vaishyas, so they like to come in Vaishya families and do those. That's just what they do in the spiritual world. You know? And others come to set those examples like that, come as sannyasis and, you know, Brahmins. And so, you know, to them it doesn't matter. They're not attached to the world. So that either comes naturally or one has to work at it. That's all. But the whole Varnashram system is natural for the living entity. Because its purpose is Krishna consciousness. Like that. It's very natural. But then one has to put that emphasis on Krishna consciousness for it to be natural. You have to bring out the natural aspect. All right? Yeah? Let's go ahead and here again. For the second time. Jai. Srila Prabhupada ki Jai.